Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Paul Ken, one of your hosts, and with me, as always, is my co-host and Bat cousin, Sean Man Bat Myers. What's new, Sean?
I was just talking to Great Grandpa Stafford, and he was telling me about his summer vacation plans. He's going to go to Hershey Park, but some of those more extreme roller coasters might be too much for him. I think he might have to stick with going through Chocolate World over and over. How about you, Paul?
I'm doing fine. I've been looking for Bat Cousin Arlene. Did you see her around anywhere? She asked me to deliver her some pudding. Anyway, our guest this month is our Bat Podcasting cousin, co-host of the Bat Pod, Bill Beer. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the reunion. What dish did you bring?
Thank you very much. I brought some cucumber sandwiches.
Ooh. Yeah.
Some crustless white bread, lightly buttered, and have thin slices of cucumbers. It's a must at any Bat Family reunion.
They're very light. I like that. Yes. Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Human Target and Alfred. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. Let's get into issue 18 of Batman Family.
You know, before we actually do that, we forgot to ask Bill what his history is with Batman Family and the reason he's got a podcast himself, who his favorite family member is. So, Bill, why don't you give us your secret origin?
Well, I guess my secret origin starts with Super Friends in the 70s. That TV show got me into the comics. And my first Batman comic that I ever picked up was Batman number 324, June of 1980, as a Catwoman cover. Batman looks like he's coming out of the sewers holding Catwoman.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Yeah. That was
Jim Aparo.
Jim Aparo, Lynn Wein, Irv Novick did the art inside. But yeah, that sort of got me into that. Batman Family was something that I didn't really know too much about. I mean, I was aware of it, but until I discovered your all's podcast is when I really got into reading it. And I started basically at your first episode and been reading it and following along and really enjoying it.
Our gift to the world, Sean, I tell you.
So as far as who's my favorite Batman family member, it's going to be Robin Dick Grayson. In this particular series, I really enjoy some of his characterization. Some of his dialogue just has me laughing out loud. I'll be reading it and laughing in another room, and everybody thinks I'm crazy in the house sort of thing. So I wanted to bring up some of the dialogue from previous issues that I really enjoyed. I have a few that I wrote down here. So Batman Family number 4, Santa asks Robin if he's a little chilly, and Robin quips, "I could hand you a line about bat thermal underwear, but I'm freezing." And then we get into number 6. Robin is being pelted by lipstick bullets by the Joker's daughter.
Yes.
And he says, "I'm not fighting back. I can't bring myself to hit a girl." The last one is from number 11. Batgirl hops into Robin's arms and he says, "Here comes the blushing bride. Allow me to carry you across the threshold," as Batgirl is punching and kicking thugs as they go. So I really enjoyed some of those scenes. So
excellent.
They're great. Yeah.
Great choices. All right. Well, you guys ready to start talking about the issue?
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So Batman Family number 18 has a cover date of June and July of 1978. And its release date was March 16th, 1978, according to Mike's Amazing World. 80-page dollar comic, I should say, rather, with a cover price of a dollar, with, get this, 5 stories. So strap in, Bat listeners, for our first 7-hour podcast. It's got 5 stories with a cover starring 4 out of the 5 members of the Batman family in the same image by Jim Starlin. So what do you guys think of the cover, Bill and Sean? Let's start with you, Bill.
I really like the cover. One of the reasons it stands out to me, I love word balloons on a cover.
Yeah.
It's like, it feels like old school. And this cover would really get me interested if I saw it on the stands to pick it up, because Batman's like, demons?
Yeah.
And it really wants you to open that book to get inside. So I really did enjoy this cover.
How about you, Sean? I know you weren't a huge fan of the Starlin pinup last issue.
So I do love this cover, but of course, my love is complicated. as some people can tell you, every figure looks great. And to a degree, I love that those huge hands are coming out of the sewer. Kind of my maybe complaint. It's not necessarily a boxed cover, because you just have the little thing in the corner. And I don't really think of that as a boxed cover. It is neat because, like, in the little Huntress inset or the circle, whatever it is, the water from the sewer pipe is like bouncing off of her little circle thing. So I like that a lot. And I think Huntress looks fantastic in that circle. This part isn't my complaint. I could see where maybe some people could have a complaint, because there's not one story starring all of the Batman family members in one story. And especially coming off of 13 with The Outsider. So you get that cover where it's all of them together. And that is like an interconnected story.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily my complaint. Yeah. My complaint is, in the Batman story, you have that great gargoyle gang and they look great. And I understand that gargoyles normally aren't in sewers, but I don't think demons are either. So I kind of don't know why they just didn't have, like, it can't be Gotham sewers are haunted by gargoyles. And then maybe an exclamation point and a question mark. And you could even kind of keep the same hands. Gargoyles could have hands like that, kind of. But just call them gargoyles. That's what they are. That's my only kind of sort of somewhat complaint about it.
Well, I like that they're all in the same scene. I know that you're right. There are people who feel a little bait and switch when they're not a scene that's exactly depicted in the comic. I never, even when I was a kid, I never really felt that way. I like that they're in the same scene. I think Huntress looks great. I love the part, just like you did, about the water dripping over her inset there. I think Man Bat and Babs look great. I'm not thrilled with the expressions on the faces of Batman and Robin, but that's a minor thing. It's an attention grabbing cover. Once again, just like Man Bat was in an awfully big delivery room last week, he's in an awfully big sewer. The sewer is like 30 feet tall.
I was thinking subway station. I was just thinking subway station, the metro station.
I think it does its job to try to entice us all to pick up the comic.
And of course, we will post the image of this cover, as well as some additional pages from each of the stories, in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Paul, remind our listeners of where that is.
That is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let's get started, Sean.
All right. Our first story is The Monstrosity Chase, starring Batman. 20 pages, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Michael Golden. The inker is P. Craig Russell, and this was later reprinted in The Legends of the Dark Knight Michael Golden hardcover from 2019. Batman in The Monstrosity Chase. Our splash page opens with Batman being gunned down by members of the Gargoyle Gang, but there are 19 more pages to go, so maybe not as all as it seems. Our story proper begins with Barry Dark, a late-night Gotham DJ walking to work in his bespoke suit. After a very quick meeting with a mugger and an even quicker meeting with the Batman, Barry is back on his way to work. Otherwhere in Gotham, aging actress Tallulah Bankhead is promoting her latest moving pictures event, a gender-swapped Hunchback of Notre Dame, when the Gargoyle Gang busts in and tries to steal a jewel-encrusted Quasimodo mask. Barry Dark reports to his listeners that Batman showed up to stop them, but was shot. However, there are 14 more pages to go, so maybe not as all as it seems. All is not as it seems, because the real Batman arrives to let us know that Robert Pattinson was hired to portray the Batman as a publicity stunt for the new Hunchback movie. The best bulk of the story involves an increasingly disheveled Barry Dark, letting us know that Batman is in the sewers pursuing the Gargoyle Gang while the Gotham Dam is overflowing, thus flooding those very same sewers. The Bat and Mouse chase concludes with an explosive ending and an almost final reveal that Betty Davis was behind the entire plot to collect the insurance money for the stolen Quasimodo mask. The last page finds our formerly natty-dressed and then unraveled DJ putting himself back together for a very early morning walk back home. I love this story. Spoiler alert. What did you guys think? How about you, Bill?
I love this story also. The artwork is incredible. I mean, I could go on for 20 minutes about the art in this.
You are a bat cousin. That is keeping in time with our podcast length. Yes, go ahead.
But yeah, I really enjoyed the story. There are a lot of things. And when we get in here and start talking about it, I have a lot of things to bring up. So yeah, this is one I really liked.
I think it's a terrific Bronze Age Batman story from Denny O'Neill. It's not a classic like some of his others, but a good adventure, a little mystery, great death trap in a sewer. Just a good, solid, excellent Bronze Age Batman tale. And for the art, I love Michael Golden. I love P. Craig Russell. And I love the art in the story. But to be honest with you, I think I like them less together. It's like, don't mix up my chocolate and peanut butter here, right? Because there's a couple places that I thought were a little wonky. They're compatible styles. But I think I prefer them when they ink them, each of them, when they ink themselves. There are some great pages, though, in this, for sure, that I'll point out. That's just my tiny nitpick.
One thing that really stuck out to me as I was trying to synopsisize the story is, obviously, comics is a visual medium. But a lot of times, what you're reading is what you're seeing. And this really is not the case. Because like as I was trying to go through and clean stuff out, oh, what did they say that was? And then I went, oh, they don't say it at all. And then I went back, oh, they don't point that out either. It's all visual, which comics should be. And I love that about the story. I don't want to say the art carries the story because that's not exactly
the
true.
The storytelling is superb. Layouts, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's just a couple places where I thought this wasn't as fantastic as it normally could be. That's all.
Going through this, so obviously the splash page is great. You have the gargoyle gang. I'm having trouble saying gargoyle. Gargoyle gang, literally.
Just call them demons.
Yeah, really. The gang riddling the Batman figure with bullets. You see the holes in his cape. And then it goes on. Barry Dark, which to my knowledge, this is his only appearance. He's a DJ. Now, I will say I love the story. It probably could be like a 9 or a 10 for me. So any nitpicky things I have, Bat Cousins, I'm not taking this apart. But he has a 5-minute walk to work, which that part is great. But he leaves like 5 minutes before he has to be on the air. And you know, that's okay. I am. If you're 10 minutes early, you're late. That's like my mindset. But still, like this guy. Oh.
I like him, too. He's the point of view character for this, which, you know, Denny O'Neill's done that more than once. And I like that. I always like the stories where it grounds. What do the people of Gotham City think about Batman? What do you think of Barry, Bill?
To me, he appears like this arrogant guy because the way he's dressed and, you know, he gets attacked by a mugger there. He would be like, okay, I'm going to get to work right on time, even though I'm like a radio host or whatever. And they'll wait for me.
I'm
he just seems like that type of guy.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Towards his idea of his fashion, it reminds me of on Barney Miller when you had Ron Glass always was about his suits and how he looked. And totally what this reminds me of. He almost gets mugged and Batman comes up and one punch knocks the mugger out.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even hang around. Like, he's like, okay, see, I'm on my way to do something. Because
Batman's a little rude.
He already knows what's going to happen on page 7 of the story, and he needs to get there in time.
He probably listened to the show, and he's not a fan.
So we turn up at, I'm not sure where we are. We're somewhere neat in Gotham City.
Yeah, it's the Gotham something. There's a sign there, but it doesn't tell us what the name of the venue is.
I'm sure smarter Bat Cousins will let us know. But there is an aging actress. For people who aren't into classic films, this person definitely is Tallulah Bankhead and Betty Davis. Her name is Tabitha Blayton, which very much is Tallulah Bankhead, you know, the same initials. And even when he says, the one reporter says, I don't know, beautiful, she ain't, but she is striking. That definitely would be Tallulah Bankhead. But the actual image of this actress is Betty Davis, especially like Betty Davis in 1978. That's her. So that's a neat thing for me, for like a classic movie fan.
My favorite quote was the other guy was like, if you can call her a woman. I was like, ouch. Ouch.
And she's super excited because she's going to mount this new production of Hunchback of Notre Dame, where she's going to play Quasimodo. It's a gender flipped idea, brand new from 1978 to change things up a bit. And of course, she has this beautiful, beautiful, maybe in quotes, beautiful mask that's all jewel encrusted, obviously worth a ton of money. So in come the Gargoyle Gang. And I love the look of the Gargoyle Gang. They're in green turtlenecks, green slacks, and then like these gargoyle masks. And the gargoyle masks look fantastic. And each of the masks is a different image of a gargoyle.
I miss the days of themed gangs that don't just take the Joker's henchmen or the Riddler's mm-hmm. henchmen. You know, we've had the Sunset Gang. We've got these guys. That's just something we don't see very much anymore.
And of course, they come in, they shoot what we think is Batman, and then they capture her. I'm going to call her Tallulah because I can never remember Tabitha. They capture Tabitha's assistant and make off with her. The actress, Tabitha, freaks out. We cut back to Barry. News has gotten to Barry that, quote unquote, Batman has been shot. And already you can see him fumbling with his tie.
Yeah. He's starting to lose his cool. I like that.
Absolutely.
I like that. At the top of that, I just want to point out, here's a good art point. Top of page 5, that panel, and A Life Ends, where they show sort of a small inset. It's the same pose. I don't know if they just copied and pasted the artwork from the splash page, but it's the same pose of the fake Batman with sort of a different color background to show that now we've caught up to the splash page, which I thought was a pretty cool effect.
Well, the nice thing about having the actual comic, you can literally put the page beside, and I think it is exactly, I think they just cut and pasted.
I think he did too. Yep.
Because the holes in the cape, the arm does seem
too
exactly.
Yeah.
The same. Yeah, that's a great touch.
I had to mention one thing here. You know, when I first read this, I didn't realize what had happened. I realized he got shot at, but I didn't realize because his shadow is in one panel and then he's punching one of the gargoyles in another. And then you see that in A Life Ends. I didn't realize that this Batman was murdered.
Yeah.
This was still Comics Code time period.
So they probably had to take a panel out or something like that.
Or just not directly refer. Mm-hmm. There's no red blood, right?
There's any no blood.
Blood that you ever see is black instead of red and all that kind of stuff. I think that you're right. It's a little more subtle.
If you read current comics, this is like so tame.
Right.
Yeah.
Compared to what we have today.
But this Batman is dead. Now, luckily, it's not the real Batman, whatever your definition of the real Batman is. This is not the real Batman. He comes in. It turns out that Tabitha hired him to portray Batman. She says he always wanted to portray Batman. Now, unfortunately, the Gargoyle Gang shot him and killed him. She says, well, I hope when you get these people, you won't be able to stand the smell of them, like how horrible they are.
You know, I thought that line was a little forced because that's the line the Batman comes back and saying, oh, you know how they're getting out. I don't know what you guys feel about that. Felt a little too obvious.
For me, I don't think it was because she's supposed to be this basically like a drama queen.
Okay.
To a degree, I understand what you're saying. I think maybe in the earlier lines, when she's talking about playing Quasimodo, I almost wish she would have been a little bit more grandiose in her speech, because then I think this wouldn't have stuck out as much. But yeah, I just think she's this drama queen that's going to make this big deal about every single thing that's happening.
I'm going to put out there that she's this actress, so she's going to overact everything.
Same thing, yeah.
Sort of the same thing. And if she is behind it, haven't got to that part yet, but it would make sense.
Yeah, no, I'll buy that.
Now, for me, where you said the smell of the bad guys is awkward, Batman explains that he's pretty sure that the Gargoyle Gang is going to escape through the sewers because someone stole the plans yesterday.
Yeah, that's a bit of a leap.
I don't know how you get that out of this. I'm glad he's right. It makes for a great story for the rest of the pages. But that was a little bit jumpy.
And you never know. There might have been some other crimes he was investigating. He went through the sewers. They went through the sewers. I know it.
So this is when Barry Exposition lets us know that the worst storm in years is coming. Yeah. I wonder why that makes me feel uneasy. We'll find out in a couple pages. He says, Alfred, hang out here at this manhole cover. I'm going down in. So he goes down in. The rest of the time in the sewer is great because Batman's going after the villains, the Gargoyle Gang, kind of like one by one. And the nice thing is, through the rest of the story, we almost are going to have to tell you what happens because it isn't really said. It is all shown. And of course, that art makes it wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So Batman comes down. There's two people acting almost as sentries. So then he goes after the two of them, does that fantastic two criminals, two hands together, knocking them on the head, knocking them out. I love that.
Boink.
Then we cut back to Barry. Barry is saying, worse, the Gotham Dam burst. It's going to flood the sewer system.
And meanwhile, you can see the water level rising in the sewer scenes. Mm-hmm. It's very nicely done.
Yes. That is a great point. All the way through, you can literally see how much higher it's getting. So then the Batman continually takes out gargoyle after gargoyle after gargoyle. Although, unfortunately, anybody who has listened to any episode of this has heard me say the word beautiful 15,000 times about Michael Golden. So if I do see something that I think kind of looks weird, again, Bat Cousins, don't come at me because I love Michael Golden. On page 10, is Batman's leg like 12 times longer than his torso? When he's kicking that bad guy, if you would follow his leg, wouldn't his foot be like 3 feet higher?
That is the challenge, as Rob Kelly would say, the challenge of foreshortening.
Yeah.
His leg, it does not look right. It's drawn too long because it's coming not quite immediately at us, but towards us on an angle. I think we're supposed to think that his back is arched backwards and thus making it look shorter. Oh,
okay. Okay. Okay.
So
okay.
He's kicking and his back goes backwards. Okay. So the idea is right, but I still think the leg's too long. And I think that's because of that difficult technique. I think that's what Rob would say. Rob, let us know. You're the artist, not me.
I do have something that saves my criticism for it. If you look in the panel to the left of that, that's spectacular. And I understand that Dick Grayson is not Bruce Wayne's biological son, but this may be the beginning of where Nightwing gets his reputation, because that panel is spectacular. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to point it out. You're going to have to look at the panel and see what I'm talking about. So if you're driving, tell Siri to make a note for you to look at this panel on page 10.
And you know, one thing that I really like in these panels in the sewers too is Batman's cape.
Oh, yeah.
The cape is fabulous.
There's
yeah.
some wonderful looking panels with it spread out as he's fighting, as he's jumping down. Took out the first two guys and he's walking past them and running. So great stuff.
There's great art all around. I like the panel of his face at the bottom of 12, left-hand bottom of 12, where you yeah. see a close-up of Batman's face. You can see his determination. He says, hey, the water's halfway up my chest. I better end this quick.
Oh, yeah.
Really great stuff.
One other thing that I liked right here, as we go on, very dark. As he's telling the story of the flood, the bad storm is coming. It's going to flood these tunnels. Batman is in there trying to save the assistant, Jamie. And he's starting to sweat. He's starting to get real nervous. He has to take off his jacket. And I sort of like the go-between between, you know, what's going on in the sewer and Barry Dark telling the yeah. story.
It's a good storytelling device. I really do enjoy it.
Barry is more freaked out than Jamie. Yeah. Jamie's in the sewer. She's living this.
She put on that fancy dress. She wasn't thinking she's going in a sewer, that's for sure.
And that's the other thing, whatever you say about Batman, he doesn't mind being in that water. It's literally sewer water.
And Alfred has to clean it. He doesn't have to clean it, so.
And also too, he doesn't even have like a mask on. I mean, he has his cow, you know, like a scuba mask or something. So I'm like,
probably doesn't smell much worse than the Batcave. I don't know.
On page 13, it's great. Basically, the page is almost cut in half, and there's one entire panel that goes down the length of that, and it is kind of almost like a waterfall kind of thing.
Yeah.
You see the water bouncing off a stone protrusion. There's water coming out of a pipe, and it's funny, quote-unquote, nothing happening in this panel, but like I can hear that rush of water coming down when I see this panel. I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. My favorite piece of art and whole story is the top of that next page on 14.
Yeah.
The layout yeah. of that. So it's the top half of the page. It's divided into three panels. And Batman is in the right two panels, but the panel is split. So there's like an empty spot. And in one, he's elbowing one guy, using his fist to punch two different guys in two different panels. It's just a fabulous layout. I really like that page.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, that's a good one. I do like that one. And I also like the panel before where he's reaching out of the sewer to grab yeah. these two guys. Yeah. He does a lot of that in here where he just comes out of nowhere and takes out these guys and, oh, maybe this isn't, I need a new career or something.
So then we go back to Barry. And Barry, that's one night, one shift. So he's been like on the job maybe 3, 4, maybe 5 hours. He looks like he's been at the end of a 3-day bender. This guy has been put through the ringer. Then we go back to the sewer and Batman is swimming underwater.
Yeah.
In sewer water. I have never respected him more than right now. I can't even, if I'm in a swimming pool or the ocean, I can't open my eyes underwater. And he has his eyes open in this water? Oh, God.
He has those little eye slits that come over. And
spoiler alert, a little bit later in the Batgirl story, she has nose filters that she's going to put in. I hope Batman has a complete head filter that he has around his face, because this story is creeping me out.
So my second favorite part, is more part of the plot, is Batman knows exactly where they're going to come out. And that's where he sent Alfred to. And what I like about this is that's improbable, but that's not impossible, right? It's not Bat God. It's not the Batman who's totally infallible. It's the Batman who's super prepared and memorized. He said he memorized the layout of the sewer. I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool. And again, like I said, I love it when Alfred helps.
So they're at this manhole cover that Alfred is on the other side. And there is a great panel, the last panel on page 16. I guess this is forced perspective because we're almost at the level of the manhole cover. The manhole cover is just a little bit ahead of us. And you see her, what's the assistant's name? Jamie. Jamie's on top of Batman's shoulders. He's holding her at her ankles. And then she has her shoe and she's tapping on the manhole cover to give Alfred the signal that we're going to blow the manhole cover open. And it's neat because at the bottom of page 17, you see one of the gargoyle gang coming out of the manhole. I think that's funny. And the police are rounding him up. Batman and Commissioner Gordon are talking, basically tells the story of the sewer system. And then Gordon says, I guess that ends it. And Batman says, not true, Commissioner. We haven't nabbed the real criminal.
Hey, did you catch the image of the Batmobile on 18? That's the Neil Adams Bat sports car mobile, the one with the bat drawing on the hood.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
He's apparently dashed out because the car door is open. So he's already jumped out and headed into the plane to confront her. That was just I didn't catch that till my second or third time through. And I thought, oh, what a nice touch.
I did like that. And I also liked how Batman was explaining to Gordon how everything went down. The sewer plans that were stolen and they were useless because they're obsolete. I like him using his detective skills. And then Gordon's kind of not a great detective in this.
No.
He's like, I don't understand what's going on.
Batman gets on the plane where Tabitha Blayton is. And there actually is a really great picture of this aging actress on the plane. And it's funny because Batman says, a contact at the State Finance Bureau told me you had insured the mask for $1 million. Since it didn't belong to you, I reasoned you planned to have it stolen and collect the insurance money. And if there is one thing I have learned by watching the Oxygen Network, is that whenever there's an insurance policy and you change that insurance policy, something bad is going to happen.
Watch out.
And actually, I have a question. Thankfully, my bat cousins learned me about colorblindness. So my partner, Monte, loves the Oxygen Network. So people who don't know, Oxygen Network is all these people getting killed and it's like a mystery. So 80% of the time, they're doing it for the insurance money because someone takes an insurance policy out on someone and then, of course, that someone dies. I just don't understand. Bat cousins, how can I take an insurance policy out on Paul and Paul not know that I took an insurance policy out on Paul and then something happens to Paul and I get to have that money? How in the world is that legal? Please educate me in the listener comments section. Okay, now that that's done, let's get back to Barry.
Question is, what did happen to the mask?
It's probably in the sewer.
It's lost in the sewer. So the insurance company has to pay somebody out. The museum, I guess she borrowed it from. I don't know.
Well, I actually don't think that they would if she's found guilty of planning this.
But the museum probably has insurance on it, then they would get paid their policy.
We get back to Barry, and Barry is putting himself together, brushing his hair, putting his tie on, putting his coat on. These two hip dudes are outside the radio station. He said, what a dude that Barry. Yeah, nothing ever bothers him.
That's a good ending.
As the sunlight streams through the Gotham cityscape.
So overall, pretty good story. If you guys are ready, I'd like to do a Bat Family history this time on our inker, P. Craig Russell. Philip Craig Russell. I never knew the P stood for Philip, so I learned something right there. So Philip Craig Russell was born in 1951 in Ohio. He studied painting at the University of Cincinnati and entered the comics industry in 1972 as an assistant to Dan Adkins, who is, you know, obviously a famous inker. He broke in with Marvel doing a few horror and actually penciled the Ant-Man strip and Marvel feature, which I did not recall. But he first became well known doing an 11-issue Amazing Adventures run and subsequent graphic novel featuring Killraven. Killraven was a hero of the future version of H.E. Wells' War of the Worlds. Don McGregor was the writer of that. And let me tell you, that's some trippy and cool looking stuff. I have the essential version of all that, and it's a pretty good read. Comics historian Peter Sanderson wrote that, quote, McGregor's finest artistic collaborator in the series was P. Craig Russell, whose sensitive, elaborate artwork, evocative of Art Nouveau illustration, gave the landscape of Killraven's America a nostalgic pastoral feel and the Martian architecture the look of futuristic castles. I thought that was cool. And around that time, he did a little bit of work for DC. He inked Batman stories in Batman Family and Detective over the pencils of Michael Golden and Jim Starlin. These are the stories we're reading right now. And in fact, the story we just read was his first DC work.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he saw very little work published in 1979 and 80 while he was producing several experimental strips, many of which were later published in his Night Music series and in Epic Illustrated, which we'll talk about in a minute. For example, he was also well known for helping Roy Thomas adapt Michael Moorcock's Elric series. Russell's first Elric story, The Dreaming City, was published by Marvel in 1982 as Marvel Graphic Novel number 2. Number 1 was The Death of Captain Marvel. Number 2 was Elric with P. Craig Russell. Number, what is it, 4 or 5 was The New Mutants, that series there. The next series, Elric of Melbourne, also written by Roy Thomas, Russell shared art duties with Michael T. Gilbert, who, of course, to plug another show, shared the spotlight with Rob on Treasury Cast about a year ago to talk about the giant book Tops. And so that story was published by Pacific Comics as Elric issues number 1 to 6 in 1983 to 84. I guess Marvel no longer had the license. Russell was a big fan and went on to adapt operas for comics. Okay, such as Wagner's, Parsifal and Mozart's The Magic Flute for Eclipse Comics between 1984 and 1990. Much of this was published as an ongoing anthology for Eclipse. That's what's called Night Music. That was his thing. At the same time, he was doing quite a bit of inking for Marvel and once in a while for DC. Presumably, now this is my thought, that was paying the bills and it took a lot less effort to ink. And so he went to his passion projects about the operas and that's why it took him a while to do it. Some of my favorite works of his at this time were the Phantom Stranger miniseries from 1987 and famously the first Elseworlds story, Gotham by Gaslight, in 1989. Both of these, of course, he was inking Mike Mignola. That, to me, is a really good match. I think it's a little bit better match than P. Craig Russell over Michael Golden. We'll see what the comments say. And in 1991, he made a little bit of press in an interview with Comics Journal as the first mainstream comic creator to come out as openly gay. In response to a statement that, quote, he was known for drawing the most beautiful men in comics. In a later interview, Russell said that during that conversation, he waffled on the answer, wasn't really sure. So when he was reviewing the transcript later, he crossed out what he said and just wrote in, because I'm gay. And that's how he came out. The good news is that in that same 1999 interview, he said it had never had an effect on his getting work, to his knowledge. He said, quote, I think nothing. If it ever hindered me, if people have not given me work because they knew I was gay, well, I haven't known about it. I've always had more offers than I could accept. I don't see much of that in the industry. They just care if you can draw. Some other notable works of P. Craig Russell include, in 1992, the Robin 3000 miniseries, where he did pencils, inks, and colors. 1993, he did the anniversary issue number 50 of Sandman, illustrating Neil Gaiman's story entitled Ramadan. He did pencils and inks there too, and that is a beautifully illustrated book. And later on, he did two other Neil Gaiman miniseries, Sandman the Dream Hunters from 2008 and American Gods, published by Dark Horse in 2017. And he actually did some writing on, I think, some of the backup strips in that one as well. And in 2008, he adopted Coraline, Gaiman's 2002 novel that was eventually made into a movie. He adapted it into like a young adult graphic novel. And finally, beginning in 2000, Dark Horse Comics published Russell's adaption of Richard Wagner's operatic cycle, The Ring of the Nibelung, over 14 issues. And finally, in 2014, it was finally collected as a single volume hardcover. And Russell calls this his magnum opus. Let's just pause about that. A 14-issue opera comic book. God bless the format of comic books. Unbelievable. In 2007, Desperado published The Art of P. Craig Russell, a 256-page retrospective of Russell's career. It was nominated for the 2008 Eisner Award for Best Comics-Related Book. And oh, speaking of awards, Russell is an 8-time Eisner winner. For example, some of his winners were in 1993, Best Pencil and Inker for the collection of Fairy Tales of Oscar Wilde, the Robin 3000 story, and an arc in Batman Legends of the Dark Knight. In 1994, he won it again for Sandman number 50. In 1998, for Elric Stormbringer and Doctor Strange, What Is It That Disturbs You, Steven graphic novel, which is a really cool book. The Ring of the Nibelung, he won that as well in 2001. Best Short Story, 2004. Death in Sandman Endless Nights. And Best Publication for Teens in 2009 for Coraline. So he has had a terrific and distinguished career. According to Mike's Amazing World, he has 164 story credits and 117 covers. But I'm not sure if that has all his independent publisher credits. I don't think I saw any of those opera covers in there because I was interested to find out. Very interesting guy. Thanks for letting me talk about him.
Oh, that was great. I know who that artist is. And I have a couple of his stuff from Marvel Fanfare.
Mm-hmm.
He did like the Scarlet Witch and the Sandman,
that stuff too.
Spider-Man. And then...
All right. You guys ready to go to story number two?
Number two.
So the second story stars Robin in The Fine Art of Murder, a 12-pager by Bob Rozakis. And I don't think Juan Ortiz has been in Batman Family yet. Inked by Dave Hunt. Reprinted in Robin the Bronze Age Omnibus, of course. We start out as Laurie is annoyed at Dick again. This time because he is spacing out during a boring art history lecture. Hey, I had one of those classes too when I was in college. So Dick, I get it. Anyway, the boredom is shattered as a sniper, not the shotgun sniper, shoots their friend, art history major Herbie, right through the window. Dick rushes out to change into Robin as Herbie dies in Laurie's arms. She has had a rough couple months after getting kidnapped last month and then this. Robin climbs to the top of the building where he confronts the shooter. The bad guy falls off the side of the roof, but Robin uses his bat rope to catch him by the foot just before he gets the ground. But by the time Robin swings down to check on him, this guy has done a Gwen Stacy. He's dead. Not from a broken neck, but somehow a knife in the back. Robin knows it must have been an onlooker in the crowd, but no one looks suspicious. Not even the woman with the totally not evil stripe of white in her hair. He changes back to Dick so he can ask his sobbing girlfriend Laurie if Herbie left any clues to his murder. Then he doesn't quite understand it when Laurie calls in him an emotionless computer brain and rushes out. See, this, guys, this is why he needs an alien girlfriend. Anyway, she did tell him that Herbie's last words were, Rembrandt, gallery, real thing. So, of course, he heads to the New Carthage Art Gallery, where Herbie had just started working yesterday, to check out the very nice Rembrandt copies they have for sale. He drops a comment that Herbie told him they have real Rembrandts for sale, and the proprietor gets real nervous and throws Dick out. After driving off, he returns his Robin, and we get a fight. The white striped hair woman was there as well, no surprise, and she tries to skewer Robin too, but fails, of course. Pretty dull sequence by the art team, if you ask me. Anyway, in our Rozakis roundup, Chief McDonald and Lieutenant Tatum show up and haul the bad guys away. There were indeed some priceless paintings in the gallery, some of which were stolen in World War II. Tatum surmises that Herbie was killed to silence him from revealing the smuggling operation. Robin agrees, but the world's second greatest detective thinks that there is more to the story and that this was just the tip of the iceberg. And just so we get it, Bob tells us that the next issue story is subtly titled Iceberg. Not the end, because we also get Laurie coming by to introduce Uncle Frank to her new friend, Hunky Dave Corby. They walk away hand in hand as Robin looks on. She's a fast worker, that Laurie. Now, the end. What'd you guys think of The Fine Art of Murder? Bill?
I enjoyed this. I enjoyed the Robin Dick Grayson sequences.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a huge fan of the art. I thought it was okay. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't my favorite. But I enjoyed the story, and there's some quirky Dick Grayson scenes in here with Robin that we'll get to. But yeah, I like this one.
How about you, Sean?
I did like it. It's much more of like a serious Robin solo story than we get. Someone actually dies. I actually like the art, Juan Ortiz. And I know I have read these stories before, and it probably says something that I don't really remember, Juan Ortiz. I do like this. I like the art in the background. Girl story. Regarding the art, it seems to be, and again, I don't mean this in a mean way, it seems not as good as Joe Staton, but a little bit more of a serious Joe Staton, if that makes sense. In the best way, I think Joe Staton is maybe not cartoony, but something like that. This is a little bit more of a serious or more like less stylized Staton, and I think that's what I like about it.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree. Staton's way better, but I can see that resemblance. I think some of the close-ups, like we get of his face, are pretty good.
Yeah.
But I'm not impressed with the action scenes. They're pretty dull, I thought. Anyway, let's start walking through. So I love the bits throughout this year and a half, Sean, we've had talking about Dick and Laurie's relationship. And we know that its days are numbered, but boy, has it been a lot of fun. And here she is, ticked off at him again because he's not paying attention in class. Yeah. And Dick is like, I learned all this stuff, you know, when I was 8, Batman teaching me about the ancient masters or whatever. I think that's funny.
One thing that almost kind of freaks me out is when you see the sights of the sniper and it's square on his cheek. And I think so much so, if that's where he would have shot him, like when his head of like
exploded.
Yeah. Then the next page, it kind of looks more like he had a heart attack because he it looks like he's clutching his chest. And thankfully his head is intact because he was able to say, Rembrandt Gallery. Nothing.
And Dick doesn't even check to see if he's dead or alive or dying. He runs out of there fast.
He does. And I just love how he's so clueless about Laurie. He goes after the guy, catches up to him pretty fast. I mean, he changed. He climbed up the building. He jumps to the other building. And then he gets to the guy all in like 4 seconds or something because the guy is still standing there. Usually when one snipes, gets out of town pretty quick, right?
I like that page where he's going after the not shotgun sniper. But I do think it would have been better had he ran into him coming down the steps or something like that. I think the layout is really neat because in the second panel, the not shotgun sniper's foot violates the panel borders. I think that looks good. And this is going to sound odd, but the second to last panel where Robin is doing some kind of push up and his feet are hitting the villain, that has no background, and that makes me think of Vince Coletta. But like all the other ones have a background, so it makes me think, okay, yeah, thank God it's not Vince Coletta. But the thing that puts in my mind, this not shotgun sniper, he looks like Alexander Goodenough in Die Hard. Alexander Goodenough was a ballet dancer and he was in Die Hard, and he's the guy in Die Hard with the long hair.
Oh, okay.
This guy looks like, now this would have been 8 years before Die Hard, but because of the long hair and everything, the way it flows, this guy looks like Alexander Goodenough, and I don't know his character name in Die Hard.
I love how he's got like almost a supervillain costume on.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not going to get away unobtrusively in that outfit.
That's one of the thing I was thinking, you know, he's in this costume and it's during the middle of the day. So you wouldn't think if he was dressed in all black or something, that might be a little suspicious, but it did seem like a supervillain costume.
I mean, it's almost like a Batman costume without the bat and the cape and the cowl.
Right.
It's like gray with blue underwear on the outside.
At the very end, the bald-headed guy that Robin goes after, he has the same shirt on. It's almost kind of like a turtleneck sleeve.
And oh, yeah,
like
you're
a,
right.
Like a turtleneck collar, but now he's just wearing like regular pants with it.
Yeah, you're right. He does have the same shirt on. I didn't notice that.
It's like what you were saying previously with the Gargoyle Gang, you know, yeah. They have like minions and all the minions are dressed alike. Because even the girl that we see is dressed in a purplish outfit.
Then we see the scene. He's hanging upside down. And by the time he swings down, wants to go over to talk to the guy. And Robin's like, I don't think so, because somebody shut him up permanently. And then we get the panel that I was referring to where you've got all the students looking on, including the woman who actually stabbed him, which is pretty funny.
She reminds me of Alexandria from Josie and the Pussycats.
And Robin says, somebody stuck it to him.
And I like that art of Robin. I think Robin looks great in that panel.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
He looks pretty good. I'll give you that. Then we get to the page that makes me laugh where Laurie is sobbing back in the classroom. He changes back to Dick. She's like, where the heck did you go? And he's like, well, somebody had to call the police, which, okay. But did he say anything? She's like, she's like, what? What are you going to solve the crime? And he's like, yeah.
This, because I know like there have been, does she know? Does she not know? It kind of was leading that she didn't know. But this interaction makes me think she doesn't know at all.
I agree. And she was getting suspicious and all that. And then all of a sudden, she has absolutely no clue by her actions here.
And you would think this would put her over the top. He definitely was gone. And then Robin all suddenly shows up and he comes back and he's trying to find out the clues and that sort of thing. And he's sort of clueless about why she's upset.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was a riot. He's like, I wish I could tell you, Chief. Sometimes I don't think I'm ever going to understand your niece. It's not like she hasn't been kidnapped last week and now she's got somebody dying in her arms this week.
Well, that's she got over the kidnapping thing really easy. She wasn't murdered. She might be worried that someone took out an insurance policy on her.
I do like the guy in the art gallery with the mustache. He like looks like an owner of an art gallery.
Definitely.
And I love the part where Dick's questioning him and he's like, now, if you're excuse me, it's closing time, you know, because it's like 1:15 on a Monday afternoon. It's closing time.
And the one thing here, he says to Dick, oh, Herbert, he had an unfortunate accident. And I'm like, okay, that dude's guilty. Unfortunate accident. He was murdered.
It's like in Chicago, where he ran into my knife. 10 times.
Right. And Sean, being a resident art expert, do you know if that's a real Rembrandt depiction on page 8? So Robin goes back, has the fight. He does take out the girl without hitting her, Bill. He just ducks, lets her conk herself in the head.
Oh, yeah.
So one thing we didn't notice, if you look at the top of page 9, the second panel, there's somebody who is writing down the license plate of Dick's van. Who is that?
It's the art gallery owner, because you can see his mustache. Like right under his nose, look at his mustache.
Ah, you're right. Okay, I sound stupid there. I'll cut that out.
No. After, 17 episodes of me sounding dumb? We're keeping that one in. Episode 18 is now my favorite of Batman Family Reunion.
Razakis roundup, and we get to meet Dave Corby.
Hmm.
And Robin's like, huh? Seeing each other a lot? Why would she dump me?
He looks like a jock, too, because he has like a letter on his.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely a jock. Well, remember, her old boyfriend was the football star, right? So she just went back to that pool.
Right. And he's like, seeing a lot of each other from now on. What does that mean? He doesn't say that, but it has a big old question mark. Like he's trying to figure out what exactly is going on there.
One thing I think is weird is the lettering at the bottom, and you will be seeing a lot of both of them, Robin, as you learn next issue just how much of your iceberg remains concealed. But did you say the next story is ice? The next story isn't called Iceberg.
I haven't read ahead, so my assumption is that the next story is called Iceberg.
No, the next story is the crime rate is earth-shaking. I just think that is the weirdest
that is weird, then.
Lettering ever, because it's like, Iceberg.
Well, I only can assume they thought the next story was going to be
that's so weird.
I think we've beat this one to death. How about you guys?
Yeah, just like Alexander Goodenough.
Let's move on to the Bat timeline. So in this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month, and we'll see what the rest of the Batman family was doing at that time. As always, we thank Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. These books, as I said before, was on sale in March of 1978. Now note, if you think about that, right, these books were on sale in March of 78. The big storm that was that winter, January or February, and that's what caused, we don't know it yet, but that's what caused a DC implosion. So we know that it's on its way. So this is sort of in that in-between phase where they had the storm and many of the comics distribution was suppressed and never gotten out. And by the middle of this year, they decide to cut the line back. So the first one with Batman in it, Batman number 300. So I remember as a kid getting this one. This has got a beautiful Dick Giordano cover. Interior art by Walt Simonson. Love how Robin, he's grown up, it's set in the future, and he's wearing the Neil Adams Earth 2 Robin outfit, which I thought was super cool. It's a really neat story. I just reread it the other day. Stories by David Reed, or Vern, it was I think his real name. He wrote a lot of Batman. He wrote that one of Who Killed Batman, that 4-issue story that we liked, Sean. So it's a really neat book. It might have been one of the very early anniversary type issues that I ever bought. So I know that that's a great one.
And I know we talk about buying it off the newsstand. I didn't buy it off the newsstand. I actually did have this when it was published. I bought it at a Rutter's. And Rutter's is like a 7-Eleven or a Wawa. For some reason, I remember I bought this after swimming lessons. So like our junior high had a swimming pool and I had to go to swimming lessons. And I hated swimming lessons. Technically, I kind of can swim. And I can't put my head down in the water and then put it to the side and breathe and then down and breathe up.
Listeners, you should see Sean's description of swimming on the camera.
So I just keep my head up, but then just do the strokes that way. When my head is above water at all time, I can breathe like anytime I want.
That stroke is called the man batty paddle.
But I do remember my quote-unquote reward for getting through swimming lessons was buying Batman 300.
There you go. That's a great story. We unfortunately have no Brave and the Bold or Detective this month.
But the next Bat appearance is Justice League of America number 155. It's called Under the Moons of Earth. And I actually don't know this story at all. But on the cover, basically the city is rumbling and Green Lantern is using his power ring to use a hand to keep up a building. Batman's swinging by with a pedestrian saving him. Superman has, I think, bus or like a green UPS truck or something. And Wonder Woman is using her magic lasso. And I'm looking over the description to see who the villain is. Oh, Captain Cold and Ra's al Ghul. I might have to read that.
Well, this is the time period of the satellite era. It's Jerry Conway when it was double-sized every month, which was really neat. And Dick Dillon could just churn them out. There's a double-size issue. And hey, throw me a World's Finest while we're at it.
And then the next one is Super Friends number 12. And this is the Atomic Twosome. And on the cover, you have a mysterious green figure. And he's saying, beware, super friends, my powers are greater than yours, and I can no longer control them. Batman and Superman are kind of like falling off a mountain. Wonder Woman is getting ready to lasso him. If you know Super Friends, this is the issue that has TNT and Dan the Dynamite.
Yeah.
Also has an appearance by Dr. Mist.
And then the last Bat appearance was World's Finest number 251, another dollar comic. With a awesome Jim Aparo cover. Superman is fighting a giant squid. And you've got Green Arrow, Black Canary, Wonder Woman, and Creeper Features. I'll keep that in too, Sean, for you. And just a great book. So, Bill, tell us what's on your list at the newsstand this month.
Of course, I did not pick anything up at the newsstand during this time because this was a little early for me. But I picked some books that I would be interested in besides the obvious Batman appearances. One of them is Aquaman number 62, where it looks like they're discussing the death of Arthur Curry Jr. Very interesting. And out of the DC, we got What If number 9. What if the Avengers fought evil during the 50s? I always liked What If in those alternate timelines.
You know, that's really cool because that's one of those ones that they later turned out to not be a what if because they liked it. Because what did they call them later, Sean? Agents of Atlas. Because of the Atlas comics. Marvel Boy and 3D Man and Venus. Yeah, that's a cool one for sure.
And the last one, which was a must pickup, was Laugh Olympics number 4.
All right. We like
from
the
cartoon.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's basically the Hanna-Barbera Olympics. You have Yogi Bear, Scooby-Doo, Snagglepuss, Dino-Mutt, Captain Caveman, Quickdraw McGraw, Grape Ape, and all those guys, yeah.
I like it. Take me out to the brawl game.
the Hanna-Barbera-verse.
Sean, what else you got? I know what your first one's going
to
be.
My first one, I actually don't own this comic. And I need to own. Yeah, I don't own this. I don't own Action Comics 500. And I don't know why. I don't have either.
Sean, those are classics.
But I do not have Action Comics 484. And I want to get it. It's the wedding of Lois and Superman on Earth 2. I really need to get that.
That's got one of the most beautiful Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, covers of Superman. Everybody knows it. Has got Lois on his shoulder as she's throwing her bouquet, and he's got a car, the just married car with the things hanging off of it with his other hand. And then in the inset, you get the little Action Comics number 1 cover. I'm like, wow, what a cover. I mean, that's like really a really iconic cover. Right? And it's a great story. And it was the impetus for Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories that showed up in the Superman family. And Sean, you will know, I just yesterday or the day before finished reading the entire run of Superman Family. So those books are ready for you when we get together next.
Listeners, this is not in prep of anything. Do not.
Not in prep. Yes, not in prep. Don't. Yes. Thank you.
Let's squash that rumor right now.
Do Superman Family. It would be much more of a slog. I enjoyed it, but some of the stories are just not very good.
I love Superman Family. Whoever starts a Superman Family pod, I will listen to every episode. I will guest on it, but I will not be hosting it or doing it. My next pick is Challengers of the Unknown, and I don't necessarily care about Challengers of the Unknown, but I do care about Deadman, and Deadman is in that issue. My next pick is Firestorm, the Nuclear Man, number 3, and that's his first series, and it's fantastic because Killer Frost is kissing him and killing him. Sometimes that's the same thing. My next choice is no surprise to anyone. It is the Superman album, the Superman Power Records BR514, and it is The Best Cop in the World and Tomorrow the World, and this is an album-sized comic and album.
Do you have that? Do you actually
have
that?
I don't own that in really real
life. I don't have any of them that are album-sized. All I have is the book and comic type things.
I do have one. I have the one with Superman punching you, it looks like.
That's the image that's in the article that Rob wrote about Neil Adams and Power Records that he uses the foreshortened terminology in the caption. I thought that was funny.
I need to read that. Yeah.
It's a good article.
The next one is, of course, our beloved Secret Society of Supervillains, starring 12,000 villains. I'm not going to read them all off, but it is Dr. Midnight and the Atom from Earth 2. So that is phenomenal. Love that. My next one technically is a pick, but it's more words into existence because this is Spider-Woman number 3, and I want a full-color Spider-Woman original series reprint run, so I don't have to buy them. Masterworks for like $18,000. So that's number 3. I need that. The next one is Spidey Super Stories number 35. It has a fantastic cover with Spider-Man being wrapped by an elephant's trunk and Shayna is saving him. It says on the cover saving, but it looks like she's trapping him.
Maybe he was going about to fall off and get knifed in the back of the board.
That could be. The next one, I have to be careful about how into this I get. So it's Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes number 240. And I guess I can only say it's Grimbor. And
I probably
have to stop talking for obvious reasons.
Go take your cold shower, Sean. We'll continue.
The next one is Superman number 324. And if one thing can sell a comic, it's a gorilla on a cover. If two things can sell a comic, it's a gorilla on a cover shooting kryptonite eye beams at Superman. And it is Titano. Fantastic. I love it. The last pick I have is Walt Disney Showcase number 44, and that is Return from Witch Mountain. That's the second Witch Mountain movie.
Okay, I was going to ask you that because I had that on my list too.
The first one is Escape to Witch Mountain, and the sequel is Return from Witch Mountain, starring Betty Davis, who also starred in this issue of Batman Family.
So did you watch those Witch Mountain movies? I was going to ask you because I assume you did.
Watch it. I don't have to watch it. I lived it. It's a story of when I was a little... No, I loved Witch Mountain. Tony and Tia, they would use like their... Oh my God. That was like... We would play that on the playground. I loved Witch Mountain.
I haven't seen it in 40 years, so I really need to watch them because I remember very fond memories of those movies. Bill, was that a little before your time, I think?
No, I remember watching those movies. Who was in a lot of those Disney movies?
Ike Iserman.
Yeah.
Tim Richards.
Sorry, I can't remember his name. No, he's married to Goldie Hawn, or that's his...
Oh, Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell, yeah. Kurt Russell was in all those movies, you know, where he ate the Wheaties and got strong. And
it's the Dexter Riley trilogy.
Right, 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 yeah.
Well, listeners, if you're Witch Mountain fans, let us know.
Oh, well, Bill doesn't know what he unleashed, because I love the Dexter Rileys even more than the Witch Mountains. That's it for me.
All right, I have a couple you didn't cover just real quick. Spidey number 181 has a retelling of the origin. You got a great cover by Gil Kane of him kneeling in front of Ben's grave, presumably saying the pain and the power and the responsibility, of course.
Yeah.
Avengers 172, terrific, terrific George Perez cover with Hawkeye standing on top of something about to shoot something. And then you got the floating heads, which we all love the floating heads covers. Showcase number 101, that's the start of the Hawkman 3-issue arc in Showcase. Got a pretty cool Joe Kubert cover, Hawkman, Hawkgirl, and Adam Strange coming through some portal or window or something. I'm not quite sure what it is. And then I'm going to go off the board here, Sean, and I'm picking up Turok, Son of Stone, number 15. So you've got a dinosaur, like a T-Rex, with much longer arms than a T-Rex, picking up a boy to get a fruit off the tree. And the caption is, Turok is alarmed by Andar's honker friend. So I don't know what this is about, but I want to read it. I'm sure that the story inside does not live up to the cover, but I had to call that one out because I really love that cover.
And of course, no trip to the newsstand would be complete if we did not give our official Richie Rich comic count for this month. In the year of our Lord, March 1978, Master Richie Rich had 12 comic books.
Yep. Super Richie. Got Super Rich. There was an article about super characters in the previous issue of Back Issues about super characters as Superboy on the front, and they talked about Super Richie and like a short article about that. So I thought of you.
All right. Something that enriches my life is Batgirl stories. So we're going to talk about a Batgirl story.
There you go.
Our third story is called Assault on the Pentagon, starring Batgirl. 12 pages, and I'll get into that. Written by Bob Rezakis, penciled by Juan Ortiz, inked by Vince Coletta, and this was later reprinted in Batgirl, the Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2 hardcover from 2019. Batgirl in Assault on the Pentagon. Barbara Gordon and Senator Tom Cleary are out on a date when Babs spies a commando force approaching the Pentagon. Our heroine springs into immediate action by taking out a few of the men with sleeping gas, then shoots one of them in the arm, and finally batarangs the last one. But her ordeal is not yet over because Madam Zodiac makes do on last issue's promise that they will meet again by showing up in issue number 18. After magically trapping some MPs in a wall, MZ tries to destroy BG, but by wrecking the walls of the Pentagon, Babs removes Madam's powers and easily decks her in the face. She once again tells Batgirl that they will meet again, but this time, fate proves her wrong. What did you guys think of the story?
I enjoyed the story for what it was. It wasn't anything super spectacular. I found it interesting. There's some corny things in there. The one thing that I really, really liked at the beginning of the story is the title, Assault on the Pentagon. And it reminded me of one of those old movies when it begins, the title flashes up, Assault on the Pentagon. And that's what made me think that. The art was okay. I didn't think it was terrible. And there wasn't anything that I would say, you gotta look at this art. That's spectacular. So
I agree with that. I actually, Sean, like the art in this one a little bit better than the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I've said it before, Vince Coletta, while we give him a hard time about a lot of stuff, his figure work and his facial, especially when he's inking the women like Babs looks very good, attractive, but it's still kind of a blah. I don't know what Babs is thinking, slapping the senator in the face.
What was he doing? What was he doing to get slapped?
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah.
He was moving in.
We'll get into that in a moment. I like this story a lot. I always say I am not an expert at these things. I am an enthusiast. I'm a lover. But I didn't even realize that Vince Coletta had inked this. Every page has backgrounds. The backgrounds did not skimp out. There's at least some backgrounds on each page. And Juan Ortiz, I like this art. I like that Batgirl is not emaciated in this at all. I think it's great. And two, what I was talking about, the page count. I like the page count because especially in these Batgirl and Robin solo stories, Robin makes out better with the supporting cast than Batgirl ever has. Some of these people you kind of know, you remember. So the story starts out with the Pentagon. It's a nice touch because the cherry blossoms, and there are cherry blossoms in Washington. So that's very nice. This assault force is coming up. Meanwhile, Babs is out on a date with Tom Cleary. Now, this part I wish would have been handled differently because Babs sees that these intruders have plans for the Pentagon. She needs to go into action. And then she's on a date, and I think she wants to be on a date, and I think she likes him. But then she has to act like she's offended because Tom wanted probably even just like a kiss.
Well, he's puckering up right there on panel 1, 2, 3, 4 on page 2.
I mean, they are in a parked car. So.
Right. So she slaps him and says, I'll find my own way home. If anything, I think she should have said, Tom, something's happening to the Pentagon. You stay here and get an account for the police. I'm going to go call the police. Something like that would have been better. I don't want Babs to miss out on her social life because of being back. But that's the only thing I didn't like about the story is that I felt bad for Babs' social life.
And she'd be like telling her friend, I was in a parked car and he tried to kiss me, so I had to slap him.
This is 1978. I mean, come on. So then Batgirl goes into action against these guys. And this is really nice. So I know we talk about when people are using their utility belts and when we like really see stuff. And I like that. And you don't necessarily see her take it out of her belt, but you see how her nose filters work. And I think that's really neat. You get an extreme close-up of her like the nose filter in her nostril. Yeah.
And to add on to that, I really like you see those little capsules on her utility belt. You see him on Batman's utility belt also. And you kind of wondered, okay, what's small enough that will fit into those? And I really like to see that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And then she goes into action. I love this part. People are shooting at her. She picks up a gun and shoots them in the arm.
Let's talk about that. That shocked me. But then she's like, hey, I used to go to the shooting range with my dad, who's a cop, who wanted me to know how to use firearms. Mm-hmm. So for her character at that time period, that makes a lot of sense.
I think in this story, she realized her parents didn't die by gunfire, so she can shoot a gun. Then someone's firing her again, and then she's like, well, I'm going to use my Batarang. She uses the Batarang. I love that. I love the cape dynamics on page 7, yeah, where you see it's like windy and the cape coming up from behind her. I like that. She goes in and she sees the muddy footprints that are going into the Pentagon, and then she sees a stripped off invasion force uniform. This I do kind of have a problem.
Yeah, no, I don't like this.
Yeah, she looks like a demon possessed.
Or a gargoyle.
Because if you look above, Batgirl artwork-wise looks very polished or smooth or whatever. And then, like, Madame Zodiac's face is just like, eh. I'm not saying rough, like she's a rough-looking woman. Rough artwork, like pencil-wise, that kind of thing. It just doesn't, I don't know if it's unfinished or, it does look like she's possessed.
I think they were going for some sort of shadow. I don't know what they were going for, but I agree with the face there does not look good.
She went heavy on the raccoon eyeshadow.
And the next page, her face is much clearer. And...
Yeah.
Yeah. I almost would believe someone else did that panel. Like how in the Super Friends Treasury, someone redrew Superman's face. I almost think that's what happened with this panel.
Yeah. Well, she's under influence of whatever the thing is on her forehead, I guess, that she's trying to.
Yeah. That's a good, yeah.
When did she get these superpowers?
This issue.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Her second and last appearance, just when she became interesting.
Yeah. And I read another appearance of her was in World's Finest. Recently. Oh. It was 4 issues. Most of the time, it was her evil doppelganger. She was hidden in a closet till the very end, and you never knew who was in there. And then she kind of helped Batman and Superman. So she's completely different here.
They didn't follow up on it, or in the Batgirl strip, let's just say.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we don't have to go back and re-edit my synopsis.
No, I'm leaving that in.
Because I thought these were the only 2 appearances of Madame Zodiac ever.
Yeah, she was in World's Finest 285 to 288.
Ooh, okay. So she's shooting laser beams out of her eyes to get to Batgirl. And she reveals to Batgirl that the reason she's so powerful now is because she is in the middle of the world's largest pentagram. So mothers, you probably won't want your children to read this because it will make them worship Satan. But Madame Zodiac, this is really cool, freezes the MPs into the wall.
Yeah, that was creepy.
I mean, that's super cool. Yeah, I like that a lot. Because you just see like random hands and arms like sticking out.
The one guy's like, help.
So then Batgirl decides, well, if this big pentagram is giving you your power, we're going to get rid of your big pentagram. And doesn't knock down the walls to the pentagram, but makes it so that the Pentagon is no longer a pentagram.
The scale is no.
Yeah, that's the thing. I like the idea of that. But on page 12, when you see all the quote-unquote damage, it's still a pentagram. The other thing is, I understand Madame Zodiac theoretically, maybe, could be a big evil deal, maybe. But Becker's literally destroying the Pentagon. So I guess it's the lesser of 2 evils, maybe? It'd be one thing if this were some demonic creature that looked horrible and was, but I'm going to go with it.
Yeah.
I was always wondering, you know, what's in that hollow spot they're fighting in? What goes on in there? So I Googled it.
Oh, all right. Someone does research instead of me. Good.
It's a 5-acre park that housed a now closed hot dog stand. At least that's what.
If only it were hamburgers, it would fit into the theme, right. The overarching theme, right, of Batman Family.
But 5 acres, that's pretty nice size.
Yeah, that is, yeah.
Doesn't look like 5 acres there, but what are you going to do? So, Sean, I thought you really would like on the last page how Babs' costume is all torn up.
Yes, we love battle damage costumes. Absolutely. Love that. I do hate that Babs is pining about her social life. How do I explain how I acted tonight? I liked it. One thing, too, I wanted to say. This is 12 pages. I like that it was 12 pages because, even though I didn't like how it ended up, it showed Babs out on a date. We had a little bit of the personal life. Because if this would have been 8 pages, that totally would have been gone.
I think it does allow more personal interactions.
Yep.
But no, and that's always good to see, because you get one dimensional all the time when they're in their costume. I mean, of course, they have to be Barbara Gordon or Dick Grayson or whoever it is. And that's always fun to see.
Yep. When you're a kid, I think all you want to see is superheroes. That's it. As a kid, that's why I cared more about DC, because I wanted to see superheroes not in peril, but in traps, and how do they get out of that? How do they solve the mystery? Sure. When I was a kid, I didn't care that Peter Parker couldn't afford rent, just because that concept didn't even understand that concept. Now, as an adult, yeah. I definitely understand Marvel more and appreciate it more and love it more. Now, I definitely like the 12 pages more than the 8.
All right, you guys ready to move on?
Absolutely.
So our fourth story is starring Man-Bat, and it is called, Man-Bat No More, a 9-pager written by Bob Rozakis, penciled by Danny Bulinati, and inked by Romeo Tatgall. Cannot find a source for it ever having been reprinted. My man Kirk was a big-time hero, back-biting snafu. He could fly and scree right by you. Uturunka looked like a fool boy. Saw him last night with his PJs on, hanging with Francine. She was playing with baby Rebecca. But all we kept talking about is glory days. Yeah, old Kirk says his man batty days are done. He's taken a real job to support his growing family and says he can't do both. He sure misses those glory days. But later that night, some really smart thieves are breaking into a coin collecting shop when Man-Bat swoops down to stop them. Strangely, he doesn't stick around for the reward. The next morning over breakfast, Kirk and Francine see the news report, and Kirk worries that he is sleep heroing. But that night, it happens again as Man-Bat stops some teenage delinquent graffiti artists. Francine says, "Honey, if you want to be Man-Bat, you don't have to sneak around. We have an open marriage." But worse news, there was a prison break last night, and Man-Bat's arch nemesis, such as it is, Snafu, has escaped. Kirk says, "Nope, not going to get in. I'm going to let the police catch him." He wants Francine to watch him that night to make sure he is not sleep screeing. And so that night, on the final page, we see Snafu causing, a snafu at Madison Square Garden as a bat creature flies in to confront him. And as we close the story, we see a close-up of the Langstrom's bedroom. And yes, indeed, there is only a single sleeping occupant in the bed, but it is Kirk. To be continued. Sean and Bill, what did you think of Man-Bat No More?
Before we start, I believe this is my favorite synopsis that Paul has ever done. I loved it from the very first word to the very last word. Bill, what did you think of the story?
I thought this was an okay story for what we had. I'm going to be honest with you up front. I'm not a Man-Bat fan at all.
Oh.
I know. did I lose connection here?
So much for getting invited back, Bill.
But I thought it was entertaining. The Man-Bat as a superhero, I don't know.
So you prefer him on the villain type?
Yeah, I think that's my preference. But I like this. This is enjoyable. It has one of those endings. I guess I want to read what happens next. So
I guess I want to
read. If you make me.
Right.
Done for the opposing viewpoint.
I am surprised. That's like the most lovable non-Man-Bat I could hear. So that was it. I like that. Elephant in the room. Yes, this doesn't have Michael Golden art or Marshall Rogers. Technically, I don't want to say it suffers because of that. You can tell there's a difference. I think the art is fine.
Yeah.
And now it's tough because, you know, you go from beautiful art to fine art, but still, it's fine.
That is exactly what I wrote in my notes. Art isn't bad, just blah, and a real come down from the last few issues.
But I do like this story. Of course, there's my asterisk of my quote-unquote complaint. I love that it kind of turns it on its head where you think he's pining for his days of Man-Bat. And theoretically, you would think the quote-unquote the woman would be, "Well, no, honey, you have to support our family." And it's not. They get rid of that right away. Francine's all on board. She's like, "Do it. Go ahead. I'm fine with this. We can make it." To love that aspect of it.
Yeah,
I love Snafu. I said this way back. It has amazed me that Snafu has not been in the animated universe. because you would have bright flashing lights, you would have sounds. I think he is a villain that is made for the animated universe. I think that is fantastic. The only thing I don't like, and this has happened in the past, spoiler alert, it's Francine who's doing it.
Spoiler alert.
The thing I don't understand is, why is it when Francine goes, quote unquote, under disguise as Man-Bat, she's not wearing pants.
Like, she's not like wearing anything.
And this has been before. Before, when it's some creature that's not Man-Bat, and who could it be? They're not wearing pants. I don't understand why Francine doesn't wear pants when she's out as Woman-Bat, Girl-Bat. I don't know what we're calling it. She-Bat? I don't know what we're calling it, but Francine-Bat. So that's my only complaint. I do like this story. I think it's set up so well. And especially like being maybe not like a multi-part story, but definitely part one. There's action. Oh, so I'm sorry. Are we going to go beat by beat?
I don't know that we have to. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward story. I agree with you that it sets up really nicely. Kirk is a real drama queen at the beginning. Like, oh, I can't be Man-Bat anymore. I'm dragged down by my ball and chain wife and kid.
He has the back of his hand on his forehead.
I like the sequence. I do think it was effective. You see Francine taking care of the baby while Kirk is moping around in his bathrobe. I love it. It's funny he couldn't get a job as a scientist. Very first story that we read in the very first episode, he was a big shot at the museum.
Yeah.
I like the characteristics of, I can't do it because it's addictive. If I do it one night a week, I'll do it two, three, four, five. Then the next thing you know, I'm doing it every night again and I can't pull down a job. I loved all that. The villains and the things that Man-Bat was stopping until we got the snafu were forgettable. But that's not the point of the story. Right. Like many other things we're talking about, the point of the story is what's going on, their relationship. She's got the bug now, which is terrific and makes more fodder for stories in the future. The pants thing has mystified me, too. I've never figured that out.
Now, there is one very important aspect of this story in terms of Bob Rozakis as a writer.
Okay.
And I'm not kidding around. On page 6, the Times reporter is Pat Caballo. On page 8, the two vandalists that are covered in red paint. One of them is Mike Babel, and the other one is Jerry Casasio. This has shown how much Bob Rozakis has improved as a writer, because he has named characters versus having a major villain who he never bothered to give a name to. This is progress.
You're like a dog with a bone, Sean. You are like ace after a bone. Yeah, just a great ending. I mean, I knew what was coming, and I still love the ending. So, Bill, if this was the first time you ever read it, had you ever heard that Francine was She-Bat previously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So okay. The ending I sort of figure out. But one thing I did want to mention is I really love, and you don't see it nowadays too much, you know, it has the little asterisk in there and it says it happened in Bat Family, you know, 15 and 16.
Yeah.
So I really like seeing those callbacks, and you don't always see that.
Do you think they don't do things like that because of Google? Because people can just Google it now. Do you think that's why?
I would assume. But I always thought that was fun to see that type of thing.
If you see it nowadays, a lot of times they'll reference the title of the trade paperback instead, because that's how presumably long-term people read it.
I also wonder maybe if they don't do it because theoretically it takes you out of the story.
I think they don't do it. They don't care as much about continuity. People back then, this is what they wanted to know. What issue did, and you're right, you can just look it up now. I mean, Mike's Amazing World, we talk about it every month.
Way back when, there was a lot of people just picking up single issues right out of the blue and maybe not necessarily be able to get the one after.
Yeah.
Right.
If you were in the middle of the story and say, well, how did this happen? And you can say, I can go back and try to find previous.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah.
So my last point on this, it's on the last page. If you look at Snafu causing trouble in Madison Square Garden, what in the world are those sound effects? Bring zap torta torta bula.
Well, that's it. It's all just, I don't even think it's bah, 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 or da, 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 da. I think it's all just weird sounds, kind of like don't make, so it's like a foghorn, a screech. No wonder I love Snafu. No wonder I want to make Snafu happen.
Again, I think the story moved the Man-Bat story forward. It's clear, we've said it before, Bob is having a lot of fun with Kirk and Francine and their situation. Got a baby now. And the new mother, what, is going out superheroing? All good stuff. Very, very exciting.
I love it. Okay, we are going to go on to Bat branding. And those are the ads and letters pages. We talk about the non-story pages of the issue. And we're going to start off at the very beginning, a very good place to start. And that is the splash page. As soon as you open up the cover, we get a splash page by Joe Staton, who I love. And it is Batman, and he's swinging through Gotham City, and Gotham City has a garbage problem, and it's very windy. because there are newspapers flying all over the place. And we see magazines and newspapers with Batgirl, Huntress, Robin, and Man-Bat. What do you guys think of this?
Oh, I really like this. It's a lot of fun.
I love the art in it. I think the length of Batman's body is a little funny, but it still looks really good. I think it's supposed to have page numbers. Again, I mentioned it last month. In the Superman family, we'd always get these Kurt Schaffenberger images of the Superman family sitting around, and you'd say, Lois Lane, page 34, Jimmy Olsen, page 47. And I think it must have fallen off, or maybe they didn't know what order they were going to put the stories in until it went to press. Or something, but it just feels like you just see the pictures of the characters. You don't see the titles of their stories or at least the page numbers, which I think is what's missing from this. Now, it doesn't mar the art that way, which is nice, but there's plenty of room that wouldn't mar the art to put story titles and stuff in there if they wanted to.
Yeah, I was almost wondering, at first I thought, was this an unused cover? Was this supposed to be a cover? But I think if you look at it, I don't think there would have been enough room and the placement for the Dollar Comics logo and the Batman family logo. So I don't think it was supposed to be a cover, but there is a lot of quote unquote empty space, which yeah. Paul, I think what you were saying. Yeah, I think it would have been pages, story names, that kind of thing. Now, I do like Joe Staton a lot. I think his stuff is great. I don't think this piece is great. I actually don't like his Man-Bat. I don't think his Man-Bat looks good at all. All the other figures I think are fine.
Well, his Huntress looks 100% on model, right? Because he's the only one who's drawn. His Batman looks pretty good. Like I said, I don't like the way his feet are. Babs is pretty good. I don't like his Robin or his Man-Bat either. Yeah, I agree with you. All right, so the next one, facing page 14 of the Batman story, is an ad for Hawkman in the Showcase. It's just neat. I'll mention it real quick. It's got a reproduction of the cover on the bottom, takes up a third of the page. Who is Hawkman? Why does Hawkman? How does Hawkman? Fanged out in the latest thrill-packed issue of Showcase. I loved Showcase. I thought it was great. I thought it was neat to see the different characters.
So I'm not trying to put us on the spot, but when Showcase was revived, the features, it was Doom Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
That special 100.
Well, Power Girl first. Or 97 to 99 was Power Girl. Then 100, which had all the characters.
Then this. Then was it that OSS?
And that was the last issue.
And then it was supposed to be Deadman.
Supposed to be Deadman, yeah.
And that's not why I'm talking about this. So Doom Patrol, Power Girl, Special 100, Hawkman, OSS. Is that it for the revival?
I don't remember what the story was of the OSS, whether that was supposed to go more issues or not. But yes, you got the sequence right.
Because I have 100, and I think I have one or two of the Doom Patrols, but I think I would like to get all of that.
I bought them off the rack, so I have them, but I don't think, I mean, the Power Girl ones might cost a little bit, but I can't imagine they cost a lot.
Now, this is one of the cases where we're talking about this, and I'm not going to run to eBay. So, listeners, Bat Cousins, you have a chance, because I'm not going to bid on these on eBay, because I've been eBaying too hard lately. You have a chance. If you want the Showcase issues, get them.
And I always like to see these kind of ads and books.
Yeah.
Especially before the internet, because you could see what was coming out and you necessarily didn't know what was coming out. And this was a good advertisement to say, hey, I need to look for that one.
Yeah. You'll say, oh, that's the one they had an ad for. That's why we did this segment, Bill. We love all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not all about the Hostess Twinkie ads. It's also that.
That is a fantastic segue, but I have to backtrack a little bit.
Oh, man.
No, you're a fantastic pause. Bat Cousins, if you haven't seen the ad, Google, I guess we'll put it in the show notes. Because underneath the who, why, and how, there's a little thing of text says, for the surprising answers to these baffling questions, read the latest thrill-packed issue of. I love that font lettering. It reminds me of movies from the 1920s or a movie serial.
Hmm.
It looks like that kind of lettering, especially for a character like Hawkman. I just think that's so in tune with that. Now, however, I will say, talking about that has made me really hungry.
For what, Sean? What are you hungry for?
How about for some Twinkies? So we're going to talk about the Aquaman Twinkie ad called Aquaman and the Imperiled Sub. And I have to say, this ad is indicative of my preparation for a podcast, because this Twinkies ad, you have Aquaman and Aqualad. They're out on the sea. They see this huge tidal wave. They duck down under. They see a sub. The sub isn't going to last. So they call their dolphin friends. The dolphin friends come. You see them going towards the sub. They help push the sub up towards the land. They're safe. Oh my gosh, this is a Twinkies ad and we didn't talk about Twinkies. Okay, last panel, we're going to talk about Twinkies. This is exactly how I plan for a podcast. I know a month ahead of time that these things are happening. We have a shell of a script. My synopsises don't go up until like 10 minutes before I'm supposed to record. Today, I was laying on the couch reading. It's 3:30. I'm like, is the podcast recording at 4 today? I'm not even sure. So this ad is exactly like how I do my podcast. Because I'm like, oh, we have one more panel. We have to do this. This is exactly how it is for me. This really is atypical of a Twinkies ad because Twinkies don't factor into this at all until the end. I'm sorry, Bill. What's your history with Twinkies?
Yeah, well, I have eaten Twinkies before. Okay. This is really gross, but we had a Twinkie eating contest at work one day. And this was about 3 or 4 years ago. I lost, but it was between me and another guy who could eat 5 the quickest. And I don't think I've had a Twinkie since because it was kind of disgusting.
So it wasn't how many Twinkies you could eat.
No, it was five.
Fast. So you limited it at least to 5. Okay.
Right. All right. Okay. Right.
I'm assuming they are wrapped. So the unwrapping process is also part. Okay. Okay.
Right.
And did he just shovel it? Because that happened.
Yeah. Shove it in. The cream was like going down his face. And it was a little disgusting. But but yeah, the Twinkie ads are fun. Even though it doesn't have anything to do with Twinkies, except they're just hanging out, enjoying a Twinkie, having a good time, socializing.
You know, I love the Twinkies ad. I'm not an expert. Bat Cousins, has any Hostess product figured less in their ad than this? Let me know, because I'd like to see. Because normally they introduce the Twinkies 2 or 3 panels in. Really, you could cut that last panel out, and it would be a fine little Aquaman one-pager.
On the opposite page of that, you've got an ad 40 years ago. It all started here with Action Comics, and it's got the wedding of Superman and Lois. And then underneath is that Batman 300. Great ad. And to your point, Bill, this kind of stuff made me excited about what was coming out. I'm like, oh, man, I want to get both of those.
Right, absolutely. It says 40 years ago, it all started here. And for the Batman book, it says today, Batman retires. Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to be there for that. What's going on?
So we're going to move on to the Batmail family. And as always, we are going to ask Mike White, Mark Lamport, and Hector Rambla. If you are listening to this, please come on to the show because we would love to hear about your experiences having your letter printed in Batman Family. And I'm not going to read everything. I'm not even going to read something from every letter, but I do love what Mike White said. It's nice to read a comic book where the writer is obviously having fun with the characters involved. Even when those characters happen to be the villains, that's very much a good tagline for this podcast. Of course, I'm talking about that pair of millionaires gone wrong, Killer Moth and the Cavalier. It seems to me that since their return in Batman Family number 10, they've been treated with less than normal respect due to criminals of their stature. Not that that treatment is wrong, though.
Stop. Criminals of their stature? What?
I love that. I had to point that out.
And what stature is that?
What is it? That is. I love that too, Sean. He goes on, Batgirl merely defeated Killer Moth, but the teen Wonder went on to make a total jackass out of the Cavalier.
Yeah, I know. He talks about Nimbor, and that's fantastic. And then the other thing I wanted to point out was Hector Rambla says that the shotgun sniper was brilliant. It's a shame that Americans do not take comics more seriously so that a feature such as Man-Bat could survive on its own rather than as a backup feature. Hopefully one day soon, comics will gain their rightful place and a strip like Man-Bat will be the lead instead of the second feature. Now we're going to move on to the next super cool ad, and that is for not Treasuries, but Limited Collector's Editions. And we have Welcome Back Cotter, which is C57, and C58, which is Superman versus Shazam. I love Captain Marvel, love Shazam. I do have to say, and although I do like that Treasury, I am a little bit disappointed because it doesn't really have any super huge, big, famous Captain Marvel villain, Shazam villain. I actually forget who the villain is. He has eyeballs for earrings. That's like what I remember from it. I should remember more from that.
I haven't read it in years, Sean. I don't remember. I can't tell you.
It's worth getting. And then we're also going to talk about The Amazing World of DC Comics, talking about Shazam. That is Amazing World of DC Comics number 17, and that's the special Shazam issue. I just recently got that within the past year. It's a great issue. The picture in the ad is fantastic because it's a somewhat realistic Captain Marvel, Captain Marvel Jr., Mary Marvel, and the Wizard Shazam. It looks great. Underneath that is the Direct Currents ad that we talked about previously.
So after the Huntress story, we get another Batmail family special delivery. And in this one, it's more debate about Robin. So the same questions that our friend Craig Boldman brought up about making Robin grow up. And we will invite Dennis Grigolier, R.H.J. Silva Jr., Charles Haskell, and Sam Herskovitz. If you're listening, please let us know. Dennis is channeling Marv Wolfman and George Perez about making Robin sexy with undoing the laces of his tunic. So I thought that was showed some foresight there. Maybe Marv or George read that letter. He also mentioned a green cape at night. Who is that? Silva, R.H.G. Silva. I don't remember Robin having a green cape.
I think in the early days, his cape was colored green. Now, whether it was miscolored, I think it was colored green. First of all, I agree about the tunic. I think the open tunic looks great.
Yeah.
I don't know necessarily that a longer cape of a different cut. I actually thought he would say more about losing the Speedo or the square cuts and go to full length pants. I could understand that more so than just changing the length of the cape.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Samuel wants to have Batmite and don't have to wait too much longer. So the big thing in this one, if you read the last paragraph before the end, he says, as for the Harlequin, there are definite plans unfolding for her to appear in her own series. But not in Batman Family. We'll be able to give you definitive information next time around, says Bob Ruzakis. The saga of the Harlequin we never saw.
Oh, so I'm definitely opening this up for Bat Cousins. Where would she have gone? Because Teen Titans was over with, so it wouldn't have been a backup in there. It wouldn't be Wonder Woman, because Huntress would have gone.
Well, not yet, though. Huntress was still in Batman Family. Maybe that's it. They put her there. They could have put her in Batman or Detective.
Oh, and that it actually kind of makes sense to have Wonder Girl and Harlequin alternate in Wonder Woman, because they're both Teen Titans. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Coming the Explosion this summer.
Oh, at the bottom,
it says Coming the Explosion.
That's true. They have the Ray. They're going to give the Ray his own comic.
They were like, yeah, it was supposed to be an explosion, but implosion.
Right. Yeah. That's what happened, right? You only got 1 month of it.
And our last Bat branding is the Superman Movie Report. And this is all about special effects. Bat Cousins, I'm not going to read this because this is like 4,000 words. Our podcasts just aren't long enough, but I am going to skip it. It is an interesting read. And the cool thing is they talk about special effects, but they also reference the other films that the people have worked on. They talk about 2001, A Bridge Too Far, You Only Live Twice, The Slipper and the Rose, One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing, which is a Disney movie. There's a grainy black and white photo of Jor-El and Laura during the destruction of Krypton. But it's neat. So we'll probably put this in the show notes. For this time, you definitely didn't have the internet. And even entertainment magazines probably wouldn't really have this in. So this was really neat. Now we are going to go on to our fifth story. The first time this has happened on this show.
And I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I know. I really am. But we are going to soldier on during our 14th hour. So we are going to talk about the Huntress in A Choice of Destinies, at last in her own series. This is 10 pages, written by Paul Levitz, penciled by Joe Staton, inked by Bob Layton, and this was later reprinted in the Huntress Dark Knight Daughter trade paperback, 2007, and the Huntress Origins trade paperback from 2020. The Huntress in A Choice of Destinies. The first Huntress solo story begins in the public interest research group of Cranston, Grayson, and Wayne, where Helena Wayne is debating whether she can do more good for the public as a lawyer or as a crime fighter. While out patrolling South Gotham, the Huntress hears the cry of a little boy letting everyone know that a fire has engulfed another street of row homes. The Huntress helps the firemen save some people and then discovers that the little boy from earlier was actually involved in setting the fire by being used by a mysterious figure in the shadows. What did you guys think of the story?
I, for one, really enjoyed this. The art is terrific.
Yep. Mm-hmm. This is Primo Staten here.
Yes, it is beautiful. And I really liked the story because this is the first one where we get the Huntress back up. I really like this. I really like Huntress a lot. I like the uniform in here, and I like that she puts part Catwoman, part Batman into her uniform. So yep. I really love this. Mm-hmm. This is right up my alley.
I agree. Great story. Like I said, great art. Very Batman-esque opening with having the Huntress face reflecting back as she's looking out the window. The sequence that Paul Levitz mentioned when I interviewed him about her qualifications and that she was made a partner right out of law school, that appears in this actual story. So we talked about that. That was cool. Just great, great stuff.
Thirded. Yep, I love it. Fantastic story. We'll get right into it. We'll zip through it. Bat Cousins, so we're not going to keep you up later than you have to be. It starts off at the law firm, and yeah, she's pondering whether or not she's going to have a better career as a lawyer than a crime fighter. What's the best thing to do? And the thing I like about this, it is 10 pages, but it does not necessarily world building, but it is her cast of characters. Yep. So it's like the people she works with, you get their personality dynamics. And the thing I really like is, you know, typical in these stories, the boss is probably like adversarial because that way then you have drama. But the boss is really great. He's really on your side. And if you have ever been lucky enough to work with someone you like and respect, oh my God, like your job is so much easier. And I really appreciated that they zigged where they could have zagged for that. I really like her boss a lot.
I like how she changes in the elevator. Good thing nobody else got on. And then she pops out of the top of the elevator. You know, you see that all the time in comics and movies. Have you ever looked up in an elevator and thought, how could I actually do that? Because
how could I even reach it?
Yeah, you can't reach it. I'm like, how would you actually do it? I don't know, but it's a common thing. And in these stories we like.
Apparently, Superman family is a theme to this episode because I remember there was an issue of, this is great comic book logic. I remember there was an issue of Superman family and a Lois Lane story. I guess the cable gets cut in the elevator and the elevator is falling. And the science is that if you are jumping when the elevator hits bottom, as long as you're up in the air, and then land safely, you'll be okay. So every time I'm in an elevator, I think of that. And I do always look up where that quote unquote panel would be that you would get out. I'm sure I could look it up on YouTube. It's like how an elevator shaft really works if you could like fit in there. So then after she changes, she goes out in the street and she's not necessarily patrolling. I think she's just kind of, and I don't know that she's investigating or patrolling. She's out on the street.
She's trying to go into that same neighborhood where the fires have been.
Where the fires were. Okay.
And I like, I thought it was very interesting. She remarks, doesn't seem to be insurance fraud involved in the fires. So she's struggling with figuring out the motive. To your point earlier, John, you know, obviously fires are ripe for that kind of insurance fraud. And she's like, nobody's claiming the insurance. So, you know, that doesn't seem to be it. So what's going on?
And then the little kid comes running up and he's like, hey, everybody, Sutter Avenue's going up. that provides like some free entertainment for the neighborhood.
Well, great sequence where she goes in to save the people on pages 7, 8, and 9. I mean, wow, that's good art there.
And I like how you see her in the background there swinging before she gets to the fire. There's two panels. One, you see her when the kid says Sutton Avenue's going up. You see
her
in the background.
Oh, yeah.
That's very Batman-esque too.
Right. Yeah, you see her swinging.
Awesome. And Sean, I thought you'd like this about the outfit. Is she somehow switches her outfit back to the red dress she was wearing at the beginning of the story behind the rubble?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It looks like she's
like swinging the cape, the inside of the cape or something. I mean, it doesn't make color sense, but it's interesting to see.
The other thing I love, like a page or two before that, I love that she takes her emblem from her belt and uses it as a hold, the utility of a costume. I think that's super cool. We're talking about pockets and vials. Yeah. So I think that was cool.
And have we ever seen her do anything like that before?
No, nothing in society, nothing in justice society. One thing though, I never will forgive Joe Staton for. It makes me very mad that the little boy who's doing this is Dondi from the newspaper strips. I know. That's a deep cut.
Sean.
I know. So that little boy looks exactly like Dondi. You have to be 108 to remember Dondi.
You're an old soul, Sean. The other guest star is Extrano from the New Guardians.
Yes. Yes. I forgot to write that down. Yes.
I'm like, well, that's where he got the model for that character from. I really did like the last page. It gives you a sense of sort of dread that Helena's feeling and her emotions. And she runs after him as Helena and the people are gone out of the alley. I don't know. I just thought it was a really effective way to end the story.
And her shadow has the...
Yeah.
You know, her cow in it. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even notice that. Oh, yeah.
Love those. Oh, that's a good catch, Phil. I didn't notice
that. Yeah, I didn't see that either. One. And they're probably putting too fine a point. But I do like that she says... And then the hunt begins. She's and I do like that.
Who doesn't like that? Well, that was a great start to the Huntress feature. We'll make sure to pop some of those pages in there. I think we're finally ready to go out dancing. You ready for it, Sean?
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to the hip hop and hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. And we're going to talk about the most 1970s moment from any of the stories. Let's just shoot out our best ones. Bill, what are your best 1970s moments from this issue?
Okay. I have a couple. Number one is when Dick's in college and saying how bored he is. The professor is smoking cigarettes while he's teaching the class.
Very good one. Good one.
And the next I have is the Man Bat story. And the kids are throwing rocks to vandal the school.
Oh, I didn't catch that one.
He's saying, yeah, when it gets hot, they won't have to complain no more because now they got air conditioning.
Oh, yeah. That's very good. Yeah.
You have any others, or is that it?
Well, I wrote down one for every one.
All right, let's hear them.
The first one I had was when we meet Barry Dark. He's in this very ugly 70s, ugly brown suit that's apparently yeah. made of mohair. And just the way it has bell-bottom pants and that sort of thing.
Marshall Golden flares.
Well, I'm going to add to that one a little bit. Mm-hmm. It talks about his suit is worth 400 easy, right? Oh, Sean, do you like this one too? And the shoes, 150. That's mid-range stuff now.
So not to shock my back, cousins, I did research.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
Today, expect to spend $400 to $799 on a suit. And that's in today's prices. Yep. So I Googled how much $450 is in 1978. That is $2,093.76.
Our man Barry's got a $2,000 suit on.
Wow, he must be making the bucks with his radio show there.
It must be syndicated.
Right.
Do you guys have anything else in that first story?
I do. So there is a payphone. You know, we talk about payphones. The fact that Barry is a DJ and kind of like talking, because nowadays I think DJs are all just automated and it's all that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see Barry behind him, there's like the reel-to-reel.
Yes, the equipment.
Tape
yes.
machine.
Yes.
But I also wanted to point out, so this is almost like a callback. On page 9, in the third panel, you see Barry in his office. You see his telephone.
And I didn't see that one.
On top of the telephone is the shoulder cradle that Michael Golden used in the Man Bat story.
Awesome pull. I did not notice that one. You got me there. That's a good one. That's a good one. Second story, other than the teacher smoking that Bill pointed out, that's all I had in story.
That's all
two.
I had. I didn't have any for Batgirl. I didn't have any in Man Bat.
Well, we've got his TV again with the antenna and the scrapbook. Now, scrapbook's still a thing, so it doesn't really count.
And he's sitting in his armchair, and he has his pipe, and he has his little, what do you call that, robe?
Yeah.
Not really robe.
Like a dressing gown.
Yeah, right, dressing right. gown.
Yeah. My guess is you guys probably have this. In the Huntress story, the call out of Ralph Nader.
Yes.
Yeah.
I looked this up, Sean. He became popular in the 70s with consumer protection and stuff. The name of one of his groups he started was Public Interest Research Group, which is almost the title of Helena's law firm.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's an ashtray on page 3. I don't know if you noticed that. Mm-hmm. We've seen those before. The last one is Helena's office furniture. If you look at her office, bottom page 3, her office furniture seems very sort of 70s-ish. And typewriter in there and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of the comments that I guess it was Roger that was making to her about her curvaceous form.
Chauvinism,
And the overall theme of urban blight and that kind of stuff, that feels very 70s, right? Very New York 70s. Yeah, not a ton of great ones in this. The suit was probably the best one, right?
Well, it's so easy. Anytime they put a price to something in 78,
we're all over that. We're so geeky.
Bill, we want to thank you for being on the show. Fantastic. Let our cousins know where they can hear you.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Had a blast. You can find me. I have a website. It's www.thebatpod.com and do a Batman podcast, of course. We call it a Batman comic book discussion podcast. And me and my co-host, J. David Weider, pick a book. Any type of book that we love and we talk about on there. We do it issue by issue. So if it's like a 4-part series, we do an episode at a time. He does an issue, I do an issue. It's a lot of fun. We don't take it too seriously. We like to have a little fun too. So
we're familiar with the concept. I will be telling your co-host to watch out for insurance policies.
Okay.
That wraps it up for this issue. Now we're going to play a podcast promo. And when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
Whoa, what are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman, could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Welcome back. We will now read and respond to your listener feedback. We actually got a real live email in our email box. How cool is that? And if anybody wants to use that, they can send it to batmanfamilyreunion@gmail.com. And this is from Engson. And he says, hello, Paul and Sean. Greetings, longtime listener. And among the things he says, the coolest things are, just wanted to stop by the reunion, drop off a store-bought dessert. It's from the Donut Planet in New York City, so they're delicious. And to offer my greetings and appreciation for you guys hosting this glorious get-together on a monthly basis. Even though, I have to be honest, I have a love-hate relationship with stories that make so many leaps of logic, as in Bob Haney, etc., that my ADD is constantly distracted by thoughts of, how did that happen? Or, where did that come from? When I read comics of that sort. I adore Amazing Man, written by Bob Razakis. But these Batman Family comics are slightly gonzo. Now, sometimes I just look at the pretty pictures and the sexy Robin Batgirl poses. And your podcast is such a joy to listen to. So I am happy to be the relative standing quietly at the far table and who doesn't contribute much to the conversation, but glad to be included. So thank you again for finding joy in these pages and sharing, and for giving us, your extended family tree, a smile. Regards, Engston. From Toronto, New York.
Awfully nice.
Thanks a lot for that email. And I really wanted to read this because, cousins, even if you don't leave a note or send an email or anything, even if you just listen to us, that's great. I listen to a ton of podcasts. And there are podcasts that I reply to every episode. And there are podcasts that I love, legitimately love, and tell people about, but I never engage in their like social media or anything. And if you don't want to, that's okay. Just enjoy what you enjoy from us, and that's cool.
All right, so let's move on. Before we get to the feedback from last month's show, we did get one last comment on the interview with Paul Levitz that came in after we recorded last month, and it was from Dr. Ange, who says, amazing episode and great discussion. I would love to chat with Mr. Levitz, although it would all be about the Legion. As a Huntress fan, great to hear his thoughts on design and decisions back then. So thanks, Ange, we appreciate it. Now, let's jump into your comments on Episode 17, Scars, Zodiacs, and Demon Babies, with our special guest, Martin Menza. Speaking of him, he left our first comment and he jumped in to say, thank you so much, Bat Cousins Sean and Paul. I had a blast talking with you all about this milestone issue from my youth. And you are more than welcome, Martin. We had a great time recording with you and are glad that you had fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. Next up, Bat Cousin and podcasting superstar Rob Kelly drops by the reunion. Martin was a great guest, knowledgeable and good-humored. I understand Sean's criticisms of Mike Kaluta's cover, but he is wrong. This is a beautiful image, and it should have been used on a poster, placemat, something. But I can also understand if, compared to merch artists like John Romita and Dick Giordano, Kaluta's work was considered too idiosyncratic and weird. Still, it's so gorgeous. Even if it is a little reminiscent of the opening credits to The Love Boat. Thank you, Rob. Rob goes on, I know I go on about Michael Golden every episode, but his work here is even more dynamic than usual. As you mentioned, Madame Zodiac deserved to return as a foe for Madame Xanadu. Maybe she did in some Vertigo book? So Michael Golden and Jim Aparo in one issue. Best dollar anyone could have ever spent. Speaking of Catfish Hunter, and when do you get to say that? He had at least another fan named Bob, in this case, Bob Dylan, who wrote a tribute to the pitcher with 1976 Catfish. And Rob, this is me talking. I'm still trying to find a way to get on Pod Dylan. You know, I can't imagine that he and Kylie ever recorded the same song in a cover, but I'm trying, I'm looking, I'm digging in. I know he did a Christmas album. I love Christmas albums. Maybe we can do it that way. We'll see. Rob then talks about, I've never seen that dollar comic ad. What a find. And what he's talking about is Isamu posted the retailer ad plan for Dollar Comics, which that's fantastic. Yeah, and that's the first time I had ever seen that. Yeah. So thank you very much for posting that, Isamu. Among many other things, we appreciate you for that. Rob goes on, this show is always good, but this one was one of my favorites. Well done. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Next up, we had, well, a bit of an unusual exchange, even for our Bat family. So Rob McCarthy kicked it off by comparing Dr. Doom's face to a half-eaten Denver omelet. Rather than being grossed out, Captain Entropy got hungry. Then they exchanged notes on where Dr. Doom got his breakfast in New York, to which Brian Schufel jumped in, asserting that Doom hung out at Coney Island to watch the hot dog eating contests, informing the contestants that, quote, Doom shall watch you ingest this pork product because Doom wills it. To which a confused Martin Gray confessed that he'd never heard of a Denver omelet until he was on a cruise just the other week. It's just an omelet with a few bits and bobs in, hardly worthy of being tied to a city. Just saying. And finally, Captain Entropy sets him straight. Martin, sometimes we just call it a Western omelet. Phew. John, I tend to call it a Western omelet, too. How about you? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I certainly have had an omelet. So this is with anything. Those things have specific ingredients. But then if you don't get one ingredient, is it still called that? I don't. If you substitute it for something else, then is it still something else? Or is it just a Denver omelet without whatever, the ham or whatever? Yeah, I don't know. So
I don't know. I like a ham and asparagus omelet, actually. So
yeah, let's move on. I do. Next up, Bat cousin Oliver Villar says, Batman Family 17 was the first comic I remember ever having.
Wow.
I know, that is fantastic.
Awesome.
I was only 4 years old at the time when this came out, and I remember finding it under my pillow as my dad, who was in the military at the time, was leaving for work. Unfortunately, I no longer have that copy, but since 2001, I've bought several replacement copies. Last time I bought a copy was at MegaCon last year. In 2011, Michael Golden signed one of my copies of number 17 at MegaCon. I'm looking forward to listening to this
Very
episode.
Cool.
Awesome, Oliver. We hope you enjoy the show. Definitely come back to the reunion more often. And Bat Cousins, feel free to let us know what your first comic was. My first comic was a Batman Family. So, and even if it's not a Batman Family, let us know what your first comic was. I love to hear stories like that.
Bucky749 left a couple more comments calling Martin a wonderful guest, and then moving on to talk about he and Jeremy enjoyed dog sitting and omelets. He then plugged an anime movie where the invading aliens are stopped by cute animals. Well, that works in any genre. You can see all the rest of his comments on the website. Thanks, Buck. Moving on to Bat Cousin Gene Papa. Great episode, guys. This has long been one of my favorite issues of Batman Family, and you did it real justice. Thanks, Gene. Regarding the tiny scar on an otherwise flawless face, it was fairly well known among fans by that point that in the 70s, Jack Kirby had originally wanted to do that with Dr. Doom in Fantastic Four, but Stan Lee refused to allow it, much to Jack's displeasure. He discussed that incident in several interviews over the years and even drew Doom removing his iron mask to show the small scar on his cheek, probably for use in a fanzine, although the image is floating around online now. It was nice to see Jerry Conway put the concept to use here. Thanks for putting that issue to bed, Gene. I knew our Bat cousins were smart.
Oh, well, I don't want to go up against any of them in Jeopardy because they'll skunk me. Next up, our Bat sister from another mister, Liz Ann Oswald, drops by the reunion. Now, note, she left some long comments, so we're picking the highlights here because our episodes are growing by like 17 hours, 19 hours already. Impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover is cool. Looks like a prog rock 70s album cover. I'm glad Robin and Batman saved Lori, but after that, Dick should have kicked her to the curb and moved on. Well, after this issue, he might not have a choice. As for Helena's outfit, women probably leave bits of clothing at Bruce's house accidentally so that he'll call and then they'll come back and get it. I have never done that, but I have heard of it being done. By the way, that is a fantastic idea. How is a human head on a snake body? Some humans can't live with organs donated from someone who doesn't match, yet somehow the lungs of a snake and its heart can work together? Then Lizanne goes on to comment on the next story and explain how Babs could have done the magic change of outfits. Okay, we believe you, Lizanne. Ah, the sports kitball. I have no idea who this catfish guy is. Moving on. The last story. The art is cool. Man-Bat has a cool logo. Not into demons. But anyway, the story was fine.
Lizanne also commented on several other things. Jack Kirby, how she was okay with that Batman pinup, even though she thought it was not Starlin's best. War comics, including Sergeant Rock and the Unknown Soldier. She was happy the Langstroms had the baby. And a name for last issue's villain. Quick change? That's up to you, Sean. I don't know. Thanks for all the comments, Lizanne. We appreciate your support.
Next up, Bat Cousin Rob McCarthy says, I don't really know any fans my age who liked Kirby when they were young. If you go from a Jim Aparo Brave and the Bold to a reprint of Hulk 1, that Hulk is going to look funny. As to the Batman poster, I don't like it either. And Jim Starlin drew my favorite series of all time, so I'm a fan. I see what he was going for, but that's some thug's mental image of Batman, but without narrative setup. It's just, what happened to his leg?
Bat past and future guest Martin Gray says, thanks for another great show, Paul and Sean, and how splendid to hear Bat Cousin Martin in there to add to the insightful news and all-around fun. What a change to hear a different kind of history lesson. I don't tend to think of giants, special issues, and annuals as dollar comics. Okay, some, such as the Superman and Wonder Woman spectaculars, had the branding. But others, for example, the Fantastic Jonah Hex spectacular and Action Comics 500, didn't. To me, it's the regular series line that were the dollar comics. Any response, Sean?
Well, it's interesting. So unintentionally, how I was talking about the Denver omelet, and you take something out, you put something, is that still a Denver omelet? At this time, if you had a DC dollar issue, if it didn't have the two bullets and the banner in the middle saying dollar comics, but it was a dollar and it was, you know, a super thick issue, was it still a dollar comic? I'll leave that for the smarter Bat Cousins to debate, even though I'm like a branding and trade dress kind of guy. I myself, in my mind, I probably would lump them in with dollar comics.
Fair enough. Back to Martin, where the other Martin thinks of Mike Kaluta as a Western cover artist. For me, he was the spooky mystery books guy. Either way, he's still a very unusual choice for the launch issue of a new dollar comic. It does declare that there's a change coming. Mm-hmm. It works so well. Heck, in my memory, this image was done by Neil Adams. As for that mild objection, none of the heads looked like they were in action. The nearest was Robin looking like he was sneezing. How clever to introduce the Huntress to the Batman family of Earth One by having at least a bit of her in every story. Yeah, we love that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I don't mind him guest starring in a terrific tale, and I know he lives in Gotham, although this issue's excellent Man-Bat fable was set in New York. The demon is not a member of the Batman family. It's fine him being here, but what's he doing getting a few strips later on? That space should have been given to perhaps a villain or Alfred or Anne Harriet. See also Human Target, Roy Raymond, The Odd Man. Hey, Martin, get ready for some weird stuff coming up. That's all.
Yeah, really.
For Steel the Indestructible Man talk, you need to listen to me and Billy D wittering on at length on his A World on Fire show. That is a great show, Martin. Thanks for letting our listeners know about it, too.
Martin goes on with a little bit of cross promotion for another show on this network, For All Mankind, and says, Robin is the worst super friend this issue. As Huntress literally says in the opening strip, can we talk? And he replies, after I beat you up. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Batman wonders, I always wondered what it would have been like to have a daughter. No, you didn't. We have seen thousands of thought balloons. You never thought that. On the other hand, it is nice that this implies that Batman thinks of Dick as his son, something which wasn't really stated at this point. That panel of Robin's shapely calves on page 10 in that opening story is certainly one for the special interest group. This is Sean. Me. I'm that special interest group. Getting back to Martin, Adam Zodiac came back in the Trinity Maxi series 27 years later. I guess someone demanded it.
Another thing I read that I don't remember her being.
Apparently, Madame Zodiac does have these powers of like, we think she had 2 appearances and she had 127 appearances, but none of them show up anywhere. So yeah, I don't know. Back to Martin. Regarding story 3, as you asked, the Man-Bat and Demon logos may not be their normal ones, but they are still better than the usual affair in early Batman family.
Let it go, Martin. Let it go.
Back to Martin. Even though I'm not a big fan of Barnum, the musical, I do like the story title, There is a Demon Born Every Minute. Is it too late for a rendition? No, never. I beg for this podcast to have more musical rendition. You should hear my outtakes that Paul cuts out. I've done Another Suitcase in Another Hall. I've done Carrying the Banner. And you guys did not get to hear it because of Paul's editing scissors.
Yeah, it's all my fault. Next up, Bat Cousin Harold Wallen comes by the reunion. He says, I still have a collection of direct currents from April 1978 through June 1979. I also have a black and white Batman paperback. I'll tweet my pics to you. To which our other Bat Cousin, Isamu Hideki Yukinori, replies, that first edition of DC Currents, which was dropped from the Amazing World of DC Comics when the feature became its own publication, was pretty cool because they had to unfold to reveal poster-sized covers. I hope you will show all of them, Mr. Wallen. My dad had only a couple of them, featuring a Joe Kubert Batman 310 cover with a gentleman ghost, and the cover to DC Comics Presents number 8, featuring Superman, Swamp Thing, and Solomon Grundy, drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praised be his name.
And Harold responded, Isamu, your wish is my command. I just tweeted the March 1978 issue with a poster-sized cover of Batman 300. You can find it in the response to the Batman Family Reunion tweets announcing this episode.
Yeah, absolutely, Bat Cousins. Go to our Twitter feed and look at that post because it is fantastic. And we thank you so much, Harold, for doing that. They are fantastic. It's amazing to me. I love DC Comics and I love all those little side projects like the Amazing World and Daily Planet. I had never seen any of these ever before in my life. So I really, really appreciate it. Next up, our Bat Pal and past guest Tim Price says, hey, a pleasure to hear from Bat Cousin Martin. It made for a great discussion as always, and I'll save a piece of cherry pie for you. About the first story, we finally have Aparo doing the interiors and get his depiction of the Huntress to boot, already worth the 4 shiny quarters. The third story was definitely weird. The interdimensional transporter must not have been up to code if it's leaking that level of radiation. How many other threats have been inadvertently released? Not a good look, JLA. I think my first demon story was Blue Devil number 12, which was fun and not at all a typical representation of Etrigan, but led to collecting his series in the 90s for a long time. Pairing him with Man-Bat was really great, especially since they aren't heroic looking. But you know, they would both have fit in well in the Gargoyles animated series. Now, this is Sean speaking. Bat Cousins, I want you to stop your podcast right now. I want you to go to Disney Plus. I want you to binge watch the entire Gargoyles animated series. I checked. It is still on there. All 3 seasons of Gargoyles are on there. It is fantastic. I love it. Wonderful. People who like Batman the Animated Series would like Gargoyles. It's wonderful. Okay, now back to the email. Michael Golden's artwork is pretty amazing, but I must be in the minority thinking the inks were too heavy, dulling some of the details. Not a deal breaker. There's plenty I love in it. And in the second story, I love getting 3 Bat heroines together. I wish we'd have more panels with Huntress and Batwoman together to compare their pointy masks, which I love as an homage to Helena, bringing Kathy's look into the modern era, and sort of a legacy from Batwoman, while also hurting my head, as I don't see an in-story explanation for why she'd do so. I'm overthinking it, right?
Yes.
Speaking of overthinking, let's not forget Madame Zodiac. A couple of years after this story, she'll return in World's Finest, teamed up with, wait for it, Dr. Zodiac. And they almost beat Batman and Superman with magic-y doodads. Now, am I a big Madame Zodiac fan? No. But she just appeared in this year's Batgirls number 13, pulling a Freaky Friday mind swap on Cassandra Cain and Stephanie Brown. So I did research her a bit and read that WF story on DCU Infinite. With this issue featuring multiple Batgirls, Babs and Helena, that may be the reason she returned to plague the present day Batgirls. That's a good...
good call out,
Tim. I absolutely think.
I've had that series of Batgirls on my list to read. I just haven't got to it. That's funny. Yeah, like Sean said, Madame Zodiac is everywhere.
Oh, well, I forgot to say, she's in the Gargoyles animated TV show. Finally, he goes on to say, last but not least, I still have my boxed set of the DC paperback books, all 6 of them. I can't recall, but I think my parents gave them to me for Christmas. Boy, I've read them a lot, and somehow they haven't fallen apart. Thanks for another great reunion, cousins. That is fantastic. I would love to see that box, because I love stuff like that. So then Isamu responded, Madame Zodiac was in World's Finest? That means she had 3 comic book appearances. She should have had a who's who entry. To the templates. And Tim says, template like the wind, Isamu. For anyone who's interested, her pre-crisis appearances included this issue and the next one, then World's Finest 285 to 288, and I was able to read them all on DCU Infinite.
Whew, that's a lot of Madam Zodiac talk. Next up, we have our Bat Pal and Network All-Star, Chris Franklin, come by the reunion. He says, sorry for the delay on responding, cousins. This is one of my favorite issues of Batman Family. I remembered seeing ads for it in some of my earliest comic purchases, but didn't get the issue until combing back issue bins in the late 80s. We didn't get a lot of Batman and Robin stories at the time, so this was a special treat. Add in the Huntress appearance, the creepy villain, the gorgeous apparel art, and you have a real winner here. Of course, Jerry Conway would return Dick to living home at Wayne Manor during his run on Batman and Detective in a few years, the last true hurrah of the original dynamic duo. I believe Jack Kirby posited that Dr. Doom had a tiny thumbnail-like scar, whereas Stan thought he was horribly disfigured from the get-go. Byrne ran with Kirby's idea, but like you said, when impatient Victor asked for that hot face plate a bit too early, either way, his face looks like 8 miles of bad cobblestone Latverian road. With a Denver omelet on top. Chris goes on, I love that poem. I can recite it without even looking at the comic. Wow, that's a devoted fan.
Yeah.
I can't remember the Gettysburg Address, but I remember this. I first read it in Best of DC number 51, the Batman Family Digest. I guess Sean was too put off by the art to remember to plug a great digest appearance. I get the like thing, but I still like the spooky Batman myself.
Yeah, I didn't remember that being in Digest. And you cousins know I will walk 8 miles out of the way to make a Digest reference on this show. So yeah, fantastic catch, Chris. Like I said, you Bat cousins will beat me in Bat Jeopardy. Chris goes on to say, letter hack Mike Tiefenbacher went on to write for DC Comics, including one of Rob and Shag's favorites, Whatever Happened to Johnny Thunder from DC Comics Presents number 28.
Very cool.
I didn't have the DC puzzle books, but I remembered the ad. I still have my childhood copy of the Batman pocket-sized paperback with Batman and Robin swinging at Two-Face, art by Adams and Giordano. Unfortunately, I decided to treat it like a coloring book. No way, not unfortunately. I love, if you still have that, post some of those pictures because I would love to see it. And dude, like you can go on eBay and get an original pristine version now. So now you have both of them. So that's good. Getting back to Chris. Gah. I listened to your feedback and realized I never got back to you on what Bob Razakis said about creating Titans West right before the book's cancellation. Here's what he had to say. The book was canceled rather abruptly. So all the East-West plans were dropped and I opted to do the origin story instead. Razakis said he planned for the team rosters to be shaken up somewhat, with Batgirl going to the East Coast and developing a love triangle with Robin and Harlequin. I wonder where Lori fit into this. Kid Flash would have been on both teams, with stories for each team happening in the book at the same time. The two factions would come together once or twice a year. In the Titans series final issue, low sales were given as the reason for the book's cancellation. I did ask him if there was any talk of giving the Titans a berth in another book, like maybe Batman Family. Jula continued to appear in Robin's stories, but there was never any plans to use the rest of the characters. There was no option of moving the series somewhere else. It was, according to stories I've heard and seen in print, canceled because some higher-ups at DC considered it an embarrassment. Thanks for the full article. Check out back issue number 65. Thanks, Chris, but I'm sorry to hear about that. It's not a great series, but at the time, I loved it.
Yeah, it's no worse or better than a lot of the other stuff DC was putting out at that time. So it's still a lot of fun.
Looking back, we can think that it was canceled, so then it was able to be revived by Wolfman and Perez. And obviously, that series is phenomenal.
Moving on, our Bat Pal and future guest, Brett Michael Young, comes by the reunion. First, he says, Chris, I had that Batman pocket-sized paperback and did the same thing. I colored in half the pages like a little five-year-old. Well, I was five-year-old, but still. Then he goes on to comment on the episode. Hi, Bat Cousins. Sorry I'm late, but I bought generic store-brand ice cream sandwiches with no means of refrigeration. Please enjoy what small portion of it is left after the outside chocolate layers are mostly stuck to the wrapper or your fingers. Bon appetit. Man, I love the old dollar comics. They always made the issue seem so exciting. Right on. As a kid, I always felt I was getting more for my dollar. Mm-hmm. That cover with the headshot in the stars isn't the most dynamic, and Man-Bat does look like they use his driver's license photo. But I'm willing to forgive for all the excitement within the comic. The Batman-Robin story was a good start to the issue, but kind of missed Robin on his own. This feels like he had to bring in Dad to solve his problems. But I'm guessing this had more to do with sales than story. That being said, it was nice seeing the pre-Bat-God days, back when Batman could get knocked unconscious with no lingering after effects by a good old-fashioned tire iron. That's the way it was, and we liked it. What have I been saying about Lori? If Dick hadn't been blowing her off, there's no way she'd end up tied to a table at a carnival with nothing between her and an acid face wash, except one very apparently sturdy, tight-fitting cork. Fortunately, Batman saves her and leaves her to her trauma until Dick comes in to check on her. By the way, Dick tells Lori if she wants to cry, they have all the time in the world. Really, Dick? You think maybe Worm Man would be freed from his cage and get some help for his body horror nightmare? How about Chicken Lady? Read the room, buddy. The Batgirl Huntress story was, well, Don Heck is back. It is the second story in a row where someone pours acid on stuff, so there's that. That's your 70s moment. Apparently, back then, vials of flesh-burning acid were readily available at your local pharmacy. It's good to see Catwoman is making sure all the flat-nosed community is gainfully employed, though she may want to rethink her hiring process after all four are taken out by tiny darts, especially the guy who yelled, "My finger!" She's not much better after Catfish disarms her by doing the twist. Again, the best story is Man-Bat. Michael Golden was hitting it out of the park like Bryce Harper. Sean? Harper is a two-time MVP currently playing professional baseball for the Philadelphia Phillies.
Thank you.
Two panels of Huntress were enough to make me want him to draw a Huntress series. Just amazing work. It's incredible to watch his art evolve and improve over just a few issues. The action is free-flowing and brilliant. Plus, it led to the other 70s moment. Back then, hospital delivery rooms were large enough to host a debutante ball. Okay, gotta go. Aunt Martha and Grandma Martha keep shouting, "Why did you say that name?" back and forth, and it's making people feel uncomfortable.
Thank you so much. Finally, an intriguing thought from a new commentator, Bat Cousin Randy Kay. Greatly enjoyable podcast, guys. One thing which struck me about this story is that, was this the last time Barbara met up with Helena before Crisis on Infinite Earths, if I'm not mistaken? Babs was there at the site where Helena was killed, along with Dick and Cole. She was there together with Batman and Jason Todd. However, there was no further follow-up on how the Bat family on Earth One felt regarding Helena's death. It would have been an interesting read, wouldn't you think? Yeah, I do really think
Sure. Yeah. It could have been right in that time in like Crisis number 11 and 12, where everybody remembered the old Earths before they said, "Wait a minute, that's not going to work. Let's get rid of it."
I think really they could have some kind of event where they go back and kind of have different issues, like how the Superman family thought about the Batman family, the mystery characters, stuff like that. That would be super cool. Now, we will acknowledge our Bat family members who shared our podcast on social media. We appreciate the support from our online community. On Twitter, things were liked and retweeted by Tim Price, the Podcrasher, John Livesay, Mike Deans, Doc Strange, Firestorm Fan, Rodney Trainum, Michael Thomas, Jim Ball, Tom Pisonet, The Bat Pod, Willie Yarborough, Ward Hill Terry, Matthew Barton, Ryan Schufo, Irredeemable Shag, Chris Lydon, Martin Gray, Outcasters, BATO Podcast, The Mirror Factory, and Justice Trek. Over on Facebook, we got some love from Van Z, Paul Wildenberger, Jay Campbell, Max Romero, Codex Omniversa, Doug Game Master, Tom Pinsono, J. David Weirder, Herschel Mimas, Joe Crow, Mike Thomas, Chris Franklin, Clinton Robinson, and August Strike Zare Knight. I believe that's how you mispronounce it, because I probably did.
All right. Whew. As most of our listeners know, Sean, running the Fire and Water Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows on the network, please consider becoming a patron. We're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the costs. And we promise not to use any of the money to buy any fake Rembrandts. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts, and thanks.
That will do it for the feedback section and for episode 18. We want to thank our special guest, Bill Beer, for appearing on this episode. Please check out the Bat Pod. It's a fun show. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next month for issue 19.